everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 336. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hola.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Hello.
And John Lindemann will be joining us later in this segment, and he will definitely be around for part two, which will be the Mega Man 3 Retroactive. I am excited for that. Also wanted to mention, I know a lot of people have been asking for opinions on things like the Nintendo not having an E3 press conference and Madden not coming to Wii U this year and other stuff. We, I think, have a pretty packed episode this week with Mega Man, but we are planning to talk about some of that stuff next week. Just hold on. Things are happening so fast in the lead up to E3 that a weekly podcast is just not the best way to keep up with all the goings on, and we don't even usually talk about news week to week anyway.
Don't even listen to this show anymore. It's not worth it.
I'm just saying we will talk about this stuff in all due time, but I would appreciate people's patience, because we can't comment on every single major thing that happens in the world of Nintendo as it happens. Last week was really good timing with the Iwata thing, and you know, I was
really
wondering,
bad timing for the E3 thing.
Yeah, because we wrapped up recording like 10 minutes before that news.
Yeah, John was actually told us, guys, we're not doing an E3 press conference right after we finish recording.
Yeah. But the Iwata thing, actually, I've been very happy with the reaction to it, because, you know, Guillaume doesn't like spending so much time on corporate stuff and like industry chatter, and I understand that, and I think he's probably not the only one. I think there's probably a lot of listeners who aren't interested in that stuff.
And believe me, I saved the listeners from some really off-topic corporate talk, so.
Sure, yeah. We go off-topic on anything.
It's because Guillaume's a plebeian.
But, you know, I think that stuff's pretty interesting, and in moderation, I like it being part of the show. So, I was a little curious, just like, you know, how many people would come around and say, I wish you guys hadn't talked about that, you know, spent so much time on that. And, actually the reactions have been really positive. So thanks everybody for your kind words. And, I hope you found it informative or just interesting. Anyway, we are going to talk about some video games here in the first part of the show. We call it New Business. And again, we expect John to jump in before the end of this segment with something. I don't know what he's going to talk about, but he should be here in time for his chance. But we're going to start with Guillaume this week.
Yeah, so before I start, I just want to clear something up. I did enjoy Etrian Odyssey 4. Even though I spent most of my time...
Are you self-correcting?
No, but it's just like, people seem to come away thinking like, oh, Guillaume didn't really like this game. And I did. I spent 71 hours on it. So you can rest assured that there was something about it that I really liked. I would play it, you know, whenever I would have a chance, and in small bursts. Like, it was really, you know, it was a fun game to go to, and... it really lends itself well for portable play, and I would just, you know, like in the subway, have like my fingers cramped around the 3DS, trying to hold the stylus and chart my progress while, you know, moving around, and I probably looked like someone who doesn't interact with a lot of people, you know, doesn't have a big social life, but who cares? Like, it was a lot of fun. So, you know, do check the game out if, I certainly wouldn't want to have talked anyone, you know, away from it. How do you say that?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, out of it. Yeah.
Yeah, out of it.
So, editor's note, the first step, make Guillaume sound like he hates Etrian Odyssey.
Thank you. So after Etrian Odyssey 4, which, you know, was a long, difficult game, I thought I'll take a breather and I'm going to dig into my backlog and find something approachable that, you know, I can pick up and play immediately. So, of course, I picked up my copy of Shuren the Wanderer DS, which I had bought a long time ago for cheap. And, you know, why not? Let's get into that.
When I think of easy and approachable, I think I really should get a roguelike.
Well, why wouldn't it be approachable? I mean, it's got like
fucking roguelike.
It's got a talking weasel. It's like, it's super cute and Japanesey, and you know, why not? Anyway, like the game, yeah, like it's got a reputation for being pretty difficult, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm on a roll here. I'm gonna jump into this game, and I had heard from some people, you know, I had heard some people say roguelikes are not RPGs. And I always thought, like, really? Like, you've got an inventory of items and, you know, you pick up a plus one sword and you gain levels and, you know, like, it's everything is turn-based. How is this not an RPG? But it turns out that I find it enough of a change of pace from RPGs to, you know, to have found it refreshing after Etrian Odyssey. If you guys, if listeners don't know what roguelikes are like.
They're like rogues.
They are the ass crack of the gaming industry.
Anyway, like, they're very punitive. Basically, you have to make it as far into a randomly generated dungeon. As far as you can, hopefully, you know, to the end of the game, but usually you'll die before that. And when you die, you die. And you start over, and you're brought back to level one, and all your progress is gone. Like, you lose your items, you lose all the levels that you gained. In Sharon the Wanderer, they kind of explain that. They say, like, well, you're not really dead. Like, you passed out, and you just show up magically in the first village of the game. So I have to assume that, you know, someone somewhere is just, like, following me in these dungeons, and whenever I get, you know, overwhelmed by monsters, he just, you know, goes to my passed out body and just takes everything I own, steals everything that I've gained, and carries me back to the first village, and there I stay in a coma until my muscles have atrophied and I'm just as weak as I started out. I guess that makes sense. But yeah, like, and the goal is that you try to approach each enemy encounter as carefully as you can. You have to prepare. You have to use your items wisely. Your items, most of the time, you're not even sure what effect they're gonna have. Like, you can pick up different sticks, and you have to use them once to find out what the effect is. And this effect will also be random. So when you start over, you're gonna have to discover all over again what the, you know, this stick of wood does, and it's really like everything is to be done again over and over again. It
kind of gives it an arcade feel, don't you think?
Kind of.
There's so little persistence in the game that it is almost kind of like, well, I died and I'm out of quarters. I got to come back tomorrow and I just have to start the whole thing over again. And I might understand the game a little better and maybe that'll help me get farther, but there's so much luck involved that, you know, any given time you go through there, you may make it really far. You might make it to the second screen and just get killed right away because you're so weak.
Yeah, like, it's very, very, you know, everything is random. So you can't really rely on something happening every time, you know, like, you have to eat food, for instance, at regular intervals, or else, like, you starve and you start losing HP and then you die. But you might not find food easily during one playthrough, but then, like, your inventory could be full of rice balls the next time that you play. Like, it's really weird that way. And yeah, like, it does have that kind of arcade quality, like, okay, well, I made it to level 20. I want to make it farther this time. And you try to progress, further and further. I had heard that Sharon the Wanderer is a little bit more forgiving than other, roguelikes because there is some sort of persistence. You know, you can, help out these non-playable characters in dungeons, and when you do something good for someone, eventually, something might change further in the game, or, you know, like, they might open up a shop that wasn't there before in a village along the way, that turns out to be really, really helpful. So I thought, okay, yeah, like, so that's pretty cool. Like, the game gets actually easier and easier as you play.
Barely.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, that's how it should be in theory, right? Like, you try to make it through the game the first time, and then you fail, and then, okay, we're going to make the game easier for you. But it was totally possible for you to do it, to make it through, you know, the first time. But that's not how it comes across in this game. In this game, it comes across as, well, okay, there was no way that you could have made it because we withheld very, very important items from you, but now you can use them. And we're withholding more items that you're gonna need, but, you know, that's, you know, you'll have to make it like 20 levels through and then die, and then maybe we'll give them to you. Maybe not. It's really weird because there's for instance, like these really useful items, called jars, that you can put stuff into. So basically it can vastly increase the number of items that you can carry. But jars are not unlocked right away. You have to make it through the game at least twice before you see jars pop up.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So you have to beat this random vindictive game that takes away everything every time you die twice to get items that make it conceivably possible to beat the game.
No, to get a random chance to get an item.
Yeah.
That would do that.
Everyone involved in this game is an emotional terrorist.
It's a fun game.
Well, yeah, it's kind of fun, but I gave up after I finally acquired the ability to get meat from monsters, which is really, really helpful. Like, when you get meat from a monster, you can then eat it, and you transform into that monster, and you gain its ability. But that was, like, the 10th time that I went through the game, and I was like, you know what, this would have been really helpful, like, the 10 previous playthroughs. And right now, I don't really feel like using this, and I'm kind of done with this game. Like, I haven't even made it through, like, a quarter of the game. There's 100 levels, and I made it through to the level, like, maybe, yeah, 25, 30. And it's just, okay, I've had enough of this. It's not really that fun anymore. And the game doesn't always seem to play by its own rules. Like, you find, like, they'll tell you, oh, like, you should really help out people along the way because then, you know, something good might happen. So, okay, cool. And then, like, you'll talk to people, they'll tell you, oh, this girl, I met this girl who was, wounded, and, you know, I helped her by throwing medical herbs at her. And then she got up and left.
I just pelted her with herbs.
Yeah, that's how you help characters in this game.
God!
So, you know, so that's how you do it. So next time I saw a blind girl, I threw my sight herbs at her. And, you know, she was like, oh, thank you. And then she left. So, okay, that was good. But then I keep seeing this girl in every playthrough. And at least in one instance, I threw herbs at her and it damaged her. And I was just like, oh, shit, I'm sorry. but you know, like, there was no explanation why it didn't work.
Because you're pelting her with stuff.
And, like, at some point, like, you see a dog, and I guess that your talking weasel that accompanies you translates for you, but the dog tells you, oh, like, you know, like, this is really, these dungeons are really dangerous, but strangers keep giving me rice balls, so I'm doing okay. So I was like, oh, okay, fine. And I threw a rice ball at him, and it just, you know, it hurt him, and then it would attack me, and then I had to put it down. He was not all that hard to beat, but then I have to live with the psychological trauma of having to put down a dog. So, thanks, game.
Maybe there's a menu option to actually give an item to someone rather than using it on them?
Nope. They really tell you, you have to throw these items at people. And, yeah, like, I looked at every menu. The menus are clearly explained. I mean, there's, you can get info on every single item in it, and it's, so, like, it's not, once you do find information, you know, like, the game is very clear as to what an item does or what this menu option does. So it's not opaque like that, you know, like, it's, the game gives you the information that you need. It just doesn't give you the items that you're gonna need the first time through or the 10th time through.
You know, I think a roguelike, this kind of dungeon, mystery dungeon crawler game, whether it's Sheeran or whether it's Pokemon Mystery Dungeon or Rogue or, you know, whatever, there's a lot of different ones out there. But even Reseteer, which a game James actually likes, by the way.
Yeah, but you don't lose every single thing when you die.
You're right, but the game is still set up very much like a roguelike. And I think, you know, a really hardcore roguelike is a game that very few people will enjoy. It's so hardcore and, you know, punishing and, just random and confusing. And it's like, oh, there's all these systems that the game doesn't really explain. You're just supposed to figure it out, and usually you'll die in the process. So very few people are going to appreciate that kind of experience. But it is a genre that has been around since, what, the 70s, I think? This was played on, like, Cray supercomputers back in universities back in the 70s. So it's been around for ages, and it's been iterated so many times that there probably is a version that you would enjoy. And for me, I played it out of sheer curiosity because I, like Guillaume, I found a cheap copy for DS, you know, a few years ago. I was like, I've never played a game like this. I've heard a lot about it. It seems very divisive, and I just want to try it and see if I like it. And for me, my experience was very similar to what Guy is talking about. You know, I was like, it was interesting, but I wasn't having that much fun, and I felt like I wasn't really making that much progress. And for me, I kind of felt like I would enjoy this if there was just a little more persistence. Like, I'm okay restarting at level one with no items at the beginning, but I wish that I had more effect on the world every time I went through. I wish there were more opportunities to interact with characters, to build things that would still be there when I went back, you know, to open up shortcuts that would let me skip over the first 10 levels out of the 100 so that I don't keep having to play the really low level stuff over and over and over again. And I guess my point is, I feel like there is a mystery dungeon game for me, but it may not exist yet. You know, I think it is possible to make a game in this style that I would absolutely adore, but based on the research that I've done, I don't know that that game exists yet, but I feel like one day it might.
Have you checked out that Chocobo game on the Wii?
No, Chocobo Mystery Dungeon, it's made by the same people as Sheer and the Wanderer, so I wouldn't expect it to be very different.
Yeah, but, you know, you like Final Fantasy music, and I've heard some remixes from that game, and the music is just fantastic. It's just, like, awesome remixes of classic Final Fantasy songs. I kind of want to check it out, just for that reason, at some point.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, very quickly, you know, while I was playing Shadow of the Wanderer, I was like, okay, maybe I'll check Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, the demo, on the eShop. So I did.
You miserable fool.
Well, you know, I wanted to see what it was about, and Pokemon Mystery Dungeon is also made by Chunsoft, so all the same controls, all the same principles apply, except that the game seems to be more focused on telling the most inane story that you've ever heard.
Much like a Pokemon game.
I suppose so, but with about 20 times more text.
Ooh.
I kid you not, like, the demo lasted me for about an hour. I would say 20 minutes of that was spent in the dungeons, and 40 minutes of that would be just watching the different Pokemons babble at each other. Like, how can kids even like that? They probably just mash a button to skip the dialogue. It was the stupidest crap that I've ever seen, and, you know, like, it wouldn't pass in a Pokemon episode, you know, the TV show, I'm sure.
It's funny you mention that, because the one that I reviewed was, I think I did Dark, I did Time, and Neil did Darkness, which was the second Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games. The story is the one thing that people universally said, okay, that's good.
Really?
Everything else is kind of garbagey.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, it actually did a relatively good job of making you like these relatively transparent characters.
Hmm.
It also kills you at the end, so that's cool. It's like, and fuck you.
Let me give you a taste of the dialogue in the demo of Pokemon Mystery Dungeon on the eShop.
Please do.
Some Pokemon sends you on a quest to go pick up some rocks for him. So you go pick up the rocks, and then you come back, and some Pokemon bumps into you. And then you go meet up with that character who gave you the mission, and you don't have the rocks anymore.
You got fleeced.
Oh my god, you don't have the rocks anymore. Where are the rocks? I could have sworn the rocks were there. I saw you pick up the rocks. Yeah, I have the rocks. Where are the rocks? I don't have them anymore. I'm looking. I don't have the rocks.
So where are the rocks?
I saw you pick up the rocks. Where are the rocks? I bumped into that guy earlier. Where are the rocks? Let's go outside. Let's go see that guy I bumped into earlier. I wonder if that's connected. Hey, the guy is not there anymore. I don't see my rocks. Do you see the rocks? Like, it goes on and on and on. Like,
so did you find the rocks?
Well, I don't know, but I've got a theory. I think that maybe the rocks and the guy who bumped into me are related. But I, you know, like the game really didn't make that clear. So I don't know. And then the demo ends. So I need to pick up the game and find out what happened to the rocks, the goddamn rocks.
It's on a dramatic cliffhanger.
Oh, I love that demo so much. That's awesome.
I'm not even exaggerating this. Like, this was basically an actual exchange.
I like Pokemon. I really do. I like the main series for its many faults. But the idea of them applying the Pokemon characters and storytelling style and everything else to a hardcore randomly generated dungeon crawler is not appealing to me. And I would say one of the advantages of just playing, you know, kind of plain vanilla Shirin the Wanderer, which is one of the more generic mystery dungeon games in that whole franchise, is that it really doesn't have all that bullshit. You know, it's kind of like you're a dude, somebody kind of tells you the main frame of what you're doing in that game.
You're looking for El Dorado.
And then you're off to the races, you know, and it's just, there is almost no story. Like, people talk to you, but not very much, you know, and it's just, cause those games are so mechanics heavy. You know, you really want to just jump in and start playing it. And like, to me, there's nothing about adding Pokemon to that formula that would make it better. It could only make it worse. And this is coming from someone who has played plenty of Pokemon and enjoyed it, but that it just is not a good fit, in my opinion.
It's a shame though, because the character models are so cute and so well made. Like, I'm not a huge Pokemon aficionado, but like, they looked really, really good. Like, I was playing, you can choose your characters at the beginning. I was playing as Snivy, and Tepig was my, assistant.
Oh, they let you pick in this game?
Yeah. And it was just like the, you know, like, holy shit, talk about cute character design. It was adorable.
Oh yeah, Tepig is very cute.
Yeah, but then, you know, he loses the rocks and all hell breaks loose.
So I wonder if letting you pick is a response to the fact that it used to be they made you do this really long ass questionnaire and then they would decide what Pokemon you were based on your answers. And I remember seeing people get bent out of shape about what the game said they were.
That's funny.
It's like, the game trolls you. I'm not a Meowth, you bastard.
I'm not a Psyduck. What are you talking about?
Oh, I am a Psyduck. Psyduck is one of my favorite Pokemon. Alright guys, so let's move on to the next, part of new business, and that's gonna be mine. I, this week, have been, rushing to finally finish off The Last Story, which was my number one game of 2012, one Nintendo game. And, you know, at the time, when we did that back in January, I guess, I was a little hesitant because I hadn't actually finished the game. In fact, I was only about halfway through it at the time. It's not a super long game. It's under 25 hours long.
Oh, easily under 25.
Very short RPG. And it's very fast-paced, but
I like what I'm hearing.
My initial impression of it was so strong that it really did kind of stand out over and above other things. And, you know, in the question of Xenoblade versus The Last Story, there's no question as to which one is more epic and grandiose and colorful you might even say exciting, depending on what excites you. And that that's Xenoblade. Xenoblade has this massive world and it's very non-linear and, you know, it's very, very anime, very Saturday morning cartoon in some respects. It's extremely colorful. It looks great, but it's also 90 fucking hours long. You know, it's just a massive grind to get through that game. To me, the great thing about The Last Story is that, you know, we have to associate these games with each other, because of Operation Rainfall and a lot of other reasons. But, The Last Story is just diametrically opposed to Xenoblade in so many ways. I mean, it is much more realistic in style. It is much more grounded in the character. The characters actually look human. They actually behave like humans, which is very weird for a Japanese RPG. But they're very likable characters. They have really interesting character interactions among themselves. This whole mercenary group that you're a part of, your main character Zale is a mercenary, and every member of that group is an interesting character, and they all have really cool relationships with all the other characters, and very much of the game is experiencing them just talk to each other about whatever's going on, about their hopes and their dreams and the problems that they're having. And, you know, and they go along with you on all these missions. And so all this is not just in cutscenes or little dialogue things between missions, but it's while you're playing the game, they're constantly talking to each other. And that's one of the great things about it, is that it doesn't feel like you're spending hours upon hours watching these drawn out cutscenes, or even just traveling from one place to another. I mean, The Last Story is a game that almost literally just warps you around to the next big action scene. You know, it is not only very linear, but extremely fast paced. It just cuts out all that stuff that bogs down other RPGs. And it's true, there's really no exploration here. So if exploration is the only thing you get out of playing an RPG, then you probably won't like this, because it's not interested in exploration.
So you don't find yourself just like hugging every wall and mashing A to, you know, find some ether or whatever?
There are very few secret things to find in the environments, and and when there are secret things, you can intuit where they are just based on the level design. You don't have to go and, you know, snoop around every single corner, or you can tell from the art design and just from the level layouts where things are. And, you know, it's almost like a choice. You can either just go straight forward to the obvious next place, or you can go over there and spend 5 minutes playing an extra battle and get a couple treasure chests. That's usually what it boils down to. They're not really hiding it all that much. So anyway, at this point, I am like an hour away from the end of the game. I tried to finish it last night, but I still need to play more Mega Man and put the show notes together for this podcast. So I didn't get to finish it, but I'm incredibly close to the end. And the wonderful thing about playing through the second half of this game over the past month or so is that at every turn, it has only validated my choice to make it my number one. I've just not only continued to enjoy the game a great deal, but I actually think I like it even better than I did when I had to put that list together. It holds up incredibly well. And, you know, even towards the end of the game, I'm learning things about the battle system. I'm learning things about the characters. And above all, I think what I appreciate so much about The Last Story is the restraint that it has. It's just not indulgent in the way that most JRPGs are. It's interested in telling you a really cool, original story that is, I would say, limited in scope compared to a lot of other JRPGs. It's not really on a global scale. You're not really saving the world. You're trying to save your city. It's not this crazy, overblown fantasy of, you know, this ragtag group of people get together and save the world. It sets its sights lower on a more intimate kind of story. And again, much of the story is about the characters interacting with each other, and it's not so much about the larger implications of what you're doing. There's some of that, but even then, you know, even in some ways you are saving the world, but the way that you're saving it and what you're saving it from is different. It's original. It's refreshing compared to stuff I've seen before.
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I mean, it's not super original. I mean, there's a race of lizard people. They're invading. I mean,
you mean the Garak or the Reptids? There's two races of lizard people.
The Garak. The Reptids are just bastards. They just hang around and be douchebags all the time.
They're more animalistic.
The Garak are actually dangerous.
I guess one thing I like about the story is that
it's the last one.
Yeah, because it's the last one. The good guys, the people that the city that you come from. You know, as the story develops, you find out they're kind of the bad guys. And the people who are attacking you, the bad guys who look really creepy and, you know, have all these weird flying creatures and everything, they might actually have the moral high ground in this conflict. And then so you have to figure out, well, you know, I mean, how do I really feel about this? I mean, you don't have a choice. It's not like Mass Effect where you choose which one dies and which one lives or anything like that. The story's going to do what it's going to do. But there's enough ambiguity in the story that I feel like it's kind of nice to play through it and feel like, you know, maybe just killing all of the enemies is not the right answer. Maybe that would actually be kind of a terrible thing to do. And this guy who's advocating for it is clearly not a nice person, and maybe I don't want to be fighting for him in his name. So anyway, I think the story is really great, actually. I think the voice acting is really great, the writing is really great, and the battle system, although relatively simple, it is very fast-paced. It is sort of action-based, you know, it's not turn-based by any means. It's definitely real-time. There's some strategy to it. There's some kind of timing and movement. The more the game goes on, the more control you have over the other people in your party, and learning when and how to use them is very important. And I am still really enjoying the battles, even at the very end of the game. And they were the first thing that I fell in love with at the very beginning of it. So that, to me, says it's a very strong battle system. And just, it's a great package overall. It's just a wonderful game, and I'm just... I love that it's getting the success that it has, you know, for XSEED and especially for a very late release on Wii. It has done very well in sales, and, you know, a lot of people are checking it out. And at this point, I think you can get it for like $20 or something. It's like getting even cheaper, and it really is a wonderful game. Just, I'm absolutely adoring it, and I'm glad to see that it holds up all the way through the end.
Are you sad to be at the end now, or are you,
I am on, I think, chapter 40 out of 41.
Yeah, its chapter system is kind of a joke, to be honest. It's like, oh, you cleared chapter one, also you cleared chapter two at the same time.
It's just that usually at the end of an RPG, I'm like, I'm really ready for this to be over.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've only been playing it for like 22 hours. So it hasn't even had the time to set in the fatigue. And it wouldn't have anyway, because it's so well paced and it's so brisk. You know, it's not just a short game, it's also brisk. It's just everything moves forward all the time. It's constantly showing you new things and taking you to new places. And, you know, there's no wandering around trying to figure out what to do next, because the game just takes you to the next thing. So it just cuts out so much of the stuff that makes RPGs drag out towards the end. You know, and I can't say whether the final boss is going to be this 3 hour, you know, 15 form thing that will make me really pissed off and make me just never bother finishing it. But based on the rest of the game, I really doubt it.
No, I seem to recall it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah, I would expect that. I would expect that the end of this game is going to be more about ending the game and ending the story than it will be about trying to throw me up against a brick wall of a final boss who is virtually impossible to beat. Because the game almost doesn't even allow grinding.
Not really. There's a couple spots in the game where you can do some stuff.
There's very rare opportunities to do bonus battles where you can get extra experience. And I usually do a couple because they're fun. But you certainly don't have to. And you can't even imagine a scenario in which... Yeah, they can't make the final boss ridiculously hard like in Final Fantasy, because if you don't beat him, what are you going to do? You can try a few different tactics, but it's not like you can go and level up everybody a whole bunch of times and then go back and try it again with better equipment and stuff. I mean, you got what you got, you know? So it's more about, it really is a kind of a roller coaster of an RPG, and I know that seems like an oxymoron, and I wouldn't have thought it was possible, but I think the last story is, that's what makes it so great. It's just, it's very, very, special game, and, you know, very refreshing for me. Much in the same way that Xenoblade was refreshing for James. For me, Xenoblade felt, on the whole, kind of conventional, just incredibly well executed in many ways. But the last story is really kind of a revolution in RPGs, in my opinion. And, you know, this was, I think, the last game that Sakaguchi worked on, and that Miss Walker worked on. And I'm very excited to hear what they're doing next. I mean, for James, the moment of the year was seeing, you know, the kind of Xenoblade sequel or whatever they're going to call it from Monolith Soft. For me, yeah, seeing what Miss Walker's doing next is, I'm getting, and this is, I think, the first Miss Walker game I've ever even played. And I'm now on pins and needles to find out what they're doing next, because this is so exciting and original.
So the answer is, well, the last thing they did was an iOS game, but I don't know what they've done since then.
I'm hoping we find out at E3, or maybe at TGS. All right, so James, what do you have for new business this week?
Not much. I've been, you know, dealing with Mega Man 3 and personal stuff, so. While we were discussing the last couple sections, at the prompting of the rest of the panel here, I went ahead and I downloaded the Panorama View demo.
Yes.
Which, it's something at least, hey. So, we actually saw this E3 2011?
11?
Yeah, because it was up in the private demo suite. And it's funny that it took them this long to pump this thing out, because it was a done product then. I wonder if it was mostly a question about how you market it. And the answer apparently is you don't. You just release it and call it a day.
The big title of 2014 is going to be The Japanese Garden.
Yeah. So actually, the one I don't see, and maybe it's out there, I'm just missing it, was the one where they were on the city streets at night in race cars. Or I guess it weren't race cars. They were just going driving really fast. Like, and that one was actually really cool. The bird was kind of ridiculous.
The bird was CG, right? That was the high-definition graphics demo.
Yeah, that was a different demo. Like, it was on the show floor, actually.
Yeah, there were two. There was one on the show floor that was the bird, and then there was the one that was the car at night. And neither of those are out. They both had CG, and these what are out right now just seem to be straight-up videos. Shot with omnidirectional cameras, which is a really cool technology, by the way.
It is. You know, I tried this, too, and it's very, you know, like, I was pretty impressed already with the Google Street View thing, but those are all static photos. So, you know, you can kind of click through them fairly quickly, but you're still just looking at pictures just from a lot of different angles. This is video, and it's rolling. And to me, the motion control of being able to look all over the place while the video continues to roll, it does kind of give it a different dimension.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a bird flying by, and you can just pan the camera over to look at it. And you can look directly in the bird's eye as it's flying on pace with this ultralight that the camera was positioned in. The demo uses scenes from, I guess there's four of them out right now?
Three or four, yeah.
Yeah, from pretty much all of them. So it gets a little bit of the Kyoto tour, which you're on a rickshaw, and the guy smiles and waves at you about 48 times. there's the birds, which is a bird's eye view of Italy, which is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, because you're flying, you're on like a, what do they call it? Like a gyrocopter kind of hang.
It's a hang glider with basically a big fan on the back.
Yeah.
And basically the birds sort of these geese basically fly in formation with the ultralight because it's what they do, and you get to just sort of watch them as they fly over things. And the other one that they showed was the double decker bus tour of London.
Yeah, that one does not seem all that appealing to me.
No, it doesn't. I mean, no offense to Londoners out there. It's just, it doesn't have the same, I mean, really, it was a lot of sitting in traffic, even in the demo.
Yeah.
It's like, the bus is stopped in front of Big Ben, not because we're taking pictures, but because there's cars in front of us. It's like, great, awesome. This is awesome. This is fantastic.
This bus tour doesn't really boil the blood in the first place.
The rickshaw tour is at least slightly charming.
Yeah, it's rustic.
Yeah, well, I mean, the part of Kyoto they're going through is rustic as hell. I mean, it looks like 1850. It's kind of a neat toy to play with because it, I mean, it's really smooth as you pan around.
That's impressive. The frame rate is just nice, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's startlingly smooth. You just pan and it's seamless. And it's an impressive piece of technology, both in the capture technique they used and in how they're presenting it. I sure as hell am not paying $2 for it.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, yeah, all the actual videos are $2. But the thing is, Nintendo hasn't told us anything about how long are they or what is the extent of what you're going to see in the video. Like the demo, the free preview part of it it's a tech demo. Like you get to see what is this experience like. Okay, experience is pretty cool, but is $2, I mean, you know, the demo is 2 minutes long. Are all these videos 2 minutes long? Because I don't really want to pay $2 for 2 minutes of video.
A dollar a minute's like strip club rate.
If they're 15 minutes long, then $2 is nothing. You know, that's right. Really cool. Like, that's something I would show my mom and dad when they come visit because they'll think it's awesome.
But would you want to do that for 15 minutes?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on how interesting the content is. That's the thing. You don't get a great sense of that from the demo. And even in their press release for this, they don't tell you how long the videos are. And that is really critical for me. So
it's like, if it's like 2.5 minutes long, ew. And if it's like 20, I don't know if I want to play Steel Diver Periscope mode for 20 minutes. It's like, I need a middle ground here. I need, you know, 5-10 minutes, maybe. It's neat. I think they probably should have given one of them away. And I don't mean a little quick demo. I mean, they probably should have just given away.
Exactly. Get you hooked.
Given away the London one and then ended it with previews of the others. Give away the most doll and then put some things at the end like, oh crap, we're on a rickshaw and we're going fast. Oh my God. And try to sell you that way.
Well, and frankly, you can probably imagine even a lot more interesting things that you could do with this. You know, you could go on a roller coaster, you could go underwater, you know, you could go on like a rainforest safari. There's so many cool places you could go. And I think this panoramic technology of just, you know, using the motion control to look around, you know, it's not just gimmicky. It really gives you the power to choose what you want to look at any given time. And there's inherent replay value in these videos because you can't possibly look in every direction at any given time. So you can watch it several times and look at different things every time. That's really cool. But it all comes down to like, what's the value proposition and where can you take me on these virtual tours that are really cool? Because when I think of like, if there's one place in the world I could kind of ride around and look all over the place, Kyoto is not really high on the list. You know, like I would love to visit there, but I don't know that it's the most visually interesting place on Earth.
Not that part. I'm kind of surprised at what they led with. I mean, if you go into like the old city where there's all the castles and shrines, yeah, it's really awesome.
Take me to Machu Picchu, man. I want to look at that shit. You know, like, there's a lot of potential in this tech.
It just might be, like, the tech might be a little bit too fragile to bring to some of the more interesting places. Like, a tropical rainforest, I would imagine that would really screw up your equipment.
I put it on an ultralight. I mean,
take it up on the International Space Station and give me a tour of that. You know, I mean, not that that's easy or cheap to do, but it would be awesome.
That one will be 2 minutes long.
No, it's pretty big, James. I hate to tell you. It takes a while to get from one side to the other. Hey, John Lindemann's here.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Good to have you, man. So, John, have you been able to play anything other than some Mega Man this week?
Yeah, actually, just purely out of curiosity, I was browsing the Nintendo eShop, as I tend to do lately. The seeds of curiosity have been sown by Mega Man and Mega Man 2 and Mega Man 3 in terms of browsing the back catalog.
Oh God.
I picked up Kirby's Dream Land for Game Boy.
What? Isn't that a baby game, you baby? Why are you playing baby games?
Well, it was Kirby's debut. I never played it. And because I never owned a Game Boy.
And he has none of Kirby's powers in this game.
He's not even pink.
He's a sickly shade of gray.
Well, he does have the one power. Like, he can absorb enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much all I can do, really. Yeah, I thought it's pretty good. It was interesting at the end seeing Sakurai's name right up there at the top of the credits, which are actually called the credits, which I got a kick out of.
And what's amazing is that if you look at Sakurai, he's old enough to even been alive when that game came out.
Yeah, how old is Sakurai now?
He's almost 50, I think.
Yeah.
How do you categorize the age of Benjamin Button?
he is actually getting younger, that's right.
He looks like he's 12 years old, but I think he's almost 50.
Yeah, that's wild. But yeah, what I was actually amazed at, I thought the game looks really good. I really like its style, like kind of like takes me back to those, because I always liked the NES graphical style, just the way that those games look. I always liked it, and that's exactly what it reminds me of. Obviously, very, you know, similar, I guess not similar tech, but kind of the same time period. So,
well, that's the cool thing about Kirby's Dream Land is that even though it's a Game Boy game, the graphics are pretty lush.
Yeah.
Yeah, big sprites.
It really does almost look like a black and white NES game, and compared to like a lot of other stuff, if you look at like Super Mario Land.
Yeah, that looks like a TI-83 game.
Kirby looks way better. It's an impressive game visually.
Yeah, I was really impressed by what they did with it. I have to say it was weird because I never owned a Game Boy, but I have to say it was really weird playing that game. Like when I first booted it up on the 3DS, I was like, wow, this is really, really old school. Like, just kind of weird. You know what it felt like? It was like I was watching like some film from like the 1920s or something. Some old school, you know, early 1900s black and white film. And it's like,
So we have found the Citizen Kane of gaming is what you're saying.
I think so. I think this is it. I think yeah, it dwells right on the eShop as we speak. But yeah, I mean, the actual game, very short. I mean, I think it's 5 worlds. I played through the whole thing in an hour.
Yeah, did you go for a second round in hard mode, or?
Is there anything different, or is it just harder?
I was a little bit surprised by how different you have to play it, because all of a sudden, like, the enemies actually attack you at really inopportune moments. Like, you'll be over a pit and you'll swallow an enemy, and when you've got, an enemy inside you, you can't float anymore. And so they'll do that trick over and over again while you're over pits. You know, like, they really screw with you in hard mode. So it's not, like, the hardest game ever, but it does present a significantly increased challenge. And I think that the enemy placement or it almost feels like Kirby games are designed with the hard mode in mind and then dumbed down. Like, it makes more sense in hard mode.
Yeah, I mean, when you describe hard mode, that's what it sounds like, because you kind of get hints of it in the normal mode. You can see, like, oh, well, that's the kind of, like, every once in a while, you know, you'll blow through, you know, an area, and then you'll hit this one part where they do a certain thing that makes it difficult. You're like, oh, that's kind of a pain in the ass. The rest of this game is so easy, right? And so you can see that. You can see how in hard mode they would just do more of that to make it, you know, you can see how they would ratchet it up a little bit.
Yeah, because, like, they really play with the fact that Kirby's actions take a certain time. You know, like, you're vulnerable when you swallow an enemy, like, for you know, a half a second there. You can't really spit it out, so you're at the mercy of everything else on the screen.
Yeah.
And, it's really on hard mode, I think, that really becomes important. And all of a sudden, like, you have to be really careful about, your moves and what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, on the normal mode, you can pretty much just fly through every stage.
Yep.
And you really don't even have to do anything. I mean, and that was almost weird. I had to almost untrain myself because I'm so used to, you have to really avoid this enemy. You do, but you kind of don't. I mean, you can just fly through every stage, and, you know, as long as you don't get hit, as long as you just avoid enemies, they aren't coming after you.
It's a lot like playing a level in Mario 3 with a P-Wing. But in that game, those are hard to get, and you have a limited number, so you use them on the really hard stages. But in Kirby, you just can do that all the time on every level.
Yeah. I mean, with Kirby, it's you pretty much just as long as you avoid spikes as Fat Kirby, you're pretty much golden. You really don't have to do much. And the bosses are trivial. I mean, the only one that's really hard is the Zeppelin boss, and even with him, you pretty much just sit there. You have unlimited shots, so you just sit there, hold down the attack button, and you just plaster him with bullets or whatever he happens to shoot, whether it's clouds or flames or whatever.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Kirby games eventually almost always end up becoming a shooter, a shoot 'em up,
which is really weird but also cute. You know, and I don't know if it was influenced by Parodius or the other way around, but it always kind of makes me think of that as, like, wow, they made a cute shoot 'em up. That's weird.
A cute 'em up.
Yeah.
That is a genre.
But yeah, I mean, is it worth the money I paid for it on eShop? I don't know. It's incredibly short.
Was it $3?
Yes, I think it's $4.
Do go through it on hard mode. I'm telling you, it's fun.
Enticing.
But yeah, but as I'm not a huge Kirby guy, I respect the Kirbster. But I'm not a huge Kirby guy, so it was kind of interesting to see where his roots are from.
All right, so why don't we go back around to Guillaume, because you've been playing a game that we've never talked about on the show.
That's true. I've been playing Quetzal's Corridors, an eShop game that is basically... It came out before another version of this game came out on WiiWare, and I think most people ignored it.
It was called Through Space.
Through Space, yeah. And there is a demo, so if you want to check that out. I had played the demo when it came out, and then I decided to pass up on that game because I found the controls a little bit, you know, less than intuitive. And I was just like, what the hell am I doing here? It's not really as fun as the trailers made it seem. And if I had to describe the game, I guess, like, what is this TV show called? Like, Hole in the Wall?
Human Tetris in Japan, but yeah, in America it's called Hole in the Wall.
Yeah, where people have to form these shapes and like this wall is approaching and they have to go through the hole in the wall. So basically you're controlling these kind of Tetris-like shapes and you know, you fly them around the screen and you're going towards a wall and you have to rotate the piece every which way, like on the X, Y, and Z axes. And so that you can make it through. Kessel's corridors decided to, you know, add some personality, I guess, to it. Like, they added a story. Now it's kind of like, it's got this Aztec theme, I suppose. The story is really not interesting. But, you know, like, I guess the visuals are kind of, you know, good looking. Like, I mean, it's kind of interesting, but I don't think it adds a terrible lot to the game.
But what about the 3D?
The 3D helps a little.
Does it look cool? Because this is almost like a Star Fox kind of perspective that you have in the game. So it feels like it's perfect for 3D.
Yeah, it kind of, like you would think, but I don't think it makes that big of a difference. Like, perhaps if the piece popped out of the screen, I would find that it looks a little bit cooler. But it you know, it's nothing really special. And the fact that you always see just like the one face of the piece that you have. So the 3D doesn't really help you figure out like the way it's configured in space, right? And like, I don't find that the 3D helps me gauge the distance between the piece and the wall. So it's not really, I don't know, it's not really, it doesn't add to the game as much as one would hope.
So would you recommend it?
It's pretty fun. Like, I was surprised. For some reason, I think that the controls on 3DS make a little bit more sense than on WiiWare. And I was using classic controller on WiiWare, so I don't know, maybe something changed in the game, or perhaps I suddenly got it. But yeah, it's pretty fun to twist the shape every which way, and basically, you've got several, like, there's a big score attack element to the game, right? Like, you can speed yourself up to go through a level faster that's going to yield you more hearts, is the, you know, the hearts are your points. Inside these holes, you'll have hearts that you can pick up. And there's also a technique where if you can basically paint your piece all over the holes in a wall, and that's called a trick, and then you basically end up picking up every heart in those holes. Like, it's hard to explain, but basically, you're just, like, placing your piece to fill up the whole thing, and the game kind of remembers, and you see, like, a trace of which part you've filled up, and once you go through the hole, then you get, like, bonus points. It's pretty cool. The thing is, though, I think that just getting through the game is pretty easy. Like, it's not really all that challenging, but then you want to improve your scores to unlock more side levels, optional levels. And when you're trying to do better, like, there's something about these quick reflex games, and it's kind of the same feeling I get with real-time strategy games. Like, I feel like my brain doesn't even have enough time to process what it's seeing, so, you know, like, it's no wonder is that my fingers don't keep up. I just feel like I've got, you know, Lisa Simpson's stubby fingers. And I'm just, like, how do people do this? Like, you panic and you press a button too many times and you just, you know, make a ton of mistakes. And, you know, like, I don't know how people get good at that game. It's incredibly stressful. But it is fun. I picked it up a while ago when it was on sale. I'm glad I didn't really, you know, pay all that much for it. But I'm enjoying it more than I thought I would.
Nice.
It's a nice game to have, you know, on the go. And because you're using regular, controls like buttons and stuff, like it makes it a little bit easier to play on, you know, a bus or, you know, in public than say Fluidity. So yeah, like it's a good game to have, you know, if you want to play in short bursts.
All right, cool. So I'm going to wrap up new business with just a few final thoughts on Assassin's Creed 3, because I beat it over the weekend, and that felt good, man. It's like a while since I beat a big, long game like that. I probably played it for like 35 hours, I'm guessing. It's, you know, and there's a ton of stuff I didn't do. There's so much side quest content that is totally optional. In the end, the only side quest I really did a lot of was the naval battles, because they're obviously the most fun. They're very addictive. And I mean, I was joking on Twitter, but I would buy like a DLC game of just ship battles in Assassin's Creed. I mean, they're that much fun.
I haven't played the remake of Sid Meier's Pirates, but isn't that kind of similar?
I know absolutely nothing about Sid Meier's Pirates.
It's kind of similar to what?
I would think that's a strategy game, but is it not?
There's several different parts to it, right?
Yeah, there's lots of things in it. I mean, there's a whole section about getting your freak on with like the women of local colonial.
Yar.
Okay. Well, the parts I've seen are like you're dueling, and there's also naval battles. But
yeah, the naval battles are not. I mean, they're not very actiony. They're much more a strategy game than anything. They're top down, and you're basically ordering your ship to get into position to fire. I mean, there's some strategy invasion stuff where you're raiding islands and stuff.
Actually, the naval battles in Assassin's Creed 3 remind me the most of what's the Overstrike Sega game? Skies of Arcadia Legends, which I played on GameCube.
James.
That's turn-based, but the satisfaction of, you know, the presentation of that game is so good. I mean, you really, even though you're in airships and in that game, when you're in the airship battles, it really does feel like naval combat. It's all about getting at the right angle before you use your weapons, because you need to be facing sort of side to side with the enemy, or else your guns are going to miss, right? And then you want to get out of their way before they have a chance to fire. So you're constantly maneuvering, you're going back and forth, you're trying to take your opportunities. Assassin's Creed 3 does all of that, except it's in real time and you're actually steering the ship. And it's challenging and it's exciting. And, you know, even though they're all on water, they actually do a nice job of mixing up the environment. So you got daytime and nighttime, and sometimes it's very beautiful sunshine, you know, calm waters, and the ships just kind of sneak out from behind a cliff. Sometimes you're out in the open sea and it's storming and there's massive waves are all over the place, and the waves really affect your opportunities for shooting, because your cannonballs will just get eaten up by the water if there's a big swell in between you and the enemy. And sometimes it's hard to see because it's nighttime and there's fog, and it's really cool. There's a lot of variety for a seemingly straightforward kind of mechanic. And it's just so satisfying when those cannons go off and you see that other ship go up in flames. I thought, how have we never done this in a video game before? You know, and you've done different versions of it, obviously, and some other things, but on this scale, I'm surprised that it took an Assassin's Creed game to make naval warfare so much fun. You know, it's certainly more fun than anything I've ever done with it. But that really kept me going, and frankly, the story, which has gotten a lot of flack, and I think it has a lot of weak points, but the story really did kind of rope me in towards the end, and I started to appreciate certain aspects of it that I probably didn't give enough credit in the early goings. Like the fact that you do start the game by playing as one character, and then you play the rest of the game as his son.
Dragon Quest V?
Dragon Quest V, yeah, sure. But because of the way Dragon Quest, because of the way Assassin's Creed works in their fiction, is that you're playing as your ancestors. So you're in the modern day, but the simulation that takes up most of the game is you're exploring the memories of your ancestors. And by making the father and son successively, you know, one is a Templar and one is an assassin, which are they're enemies of each other, right? But because they're father and son, it means that you actually get to play as both of them in the game, and then they coexist for, you know, a large portion of the game. So at one point, you know, you're playing the son, you're trying to kill your father because he's a Templar, but then you team up for a while and you're actually talking with each other. And it's really cool because you as the player have actually played as both of these characters. And so you can sort of see things from both of their perspectives, and it gives the story a flavor that I've never really seen before. It's like, it's really weird seeing these cutscenes, and, you know, and also they're both highly trained assassins, you know, for whatever term you want to say, but there are missions where you are running around with your father all over rooftops, and you're jumping down and you're killing dudes silently, and then you're stealing their clothes, and then you run off back into the shadows, and you go, you know, climb up this tower together. It's like the whole, like, you know, jungle gym kind of gameplay of Assassin's Creed, Uncharted, Tomb Raider, whatever. It's really interesting to be doing that with another character who is just as good at it as you are. Because sometimes you do that stuff in Uncharted, but it always seems like the other characters are not nearly as good at climbing as Nathan Drake, and so you end up kind of going off on your own, and then you drop a rope down from on high so they can get up the easy way. In this game, you're just trying to keep up with your dad sometimes, you know, and they have a very icy relationship. Like, they talk about the mother and what happened to her, and you find out that the dad didn't even know about it. And so shit gets real thorny with them, and, you know, it ends badly, as it was destined to do, of course. But I just thought, you know, this is actually a really cool use of the Assassin's Creed theme that I don't know that these guys are, you know, the developer, I don't know that they're given enough credit for finding a way for you to play as father versus son when you've actually controlled both of them as the player. That is something I've never seen in video games, and it plays out in a pretty interesting way, you know, and that is over and above, you know, you're playing as a Native American character, which is almost unheard of in video games. And I mean, I'm not saying it's historically accurate or even culturally sensitive, but you're doing things that Native Americans would do that you would never do in any other video game. You know, you're out in the woods hunting, and you're, you know, having these conversations around, you know, in their Iroquois long houses, and, you know, sitting around campfires, and you go on a spiritual quest, and, you know, you're running through the treetops, which is really cool and has definitely never been done before. And, you know, really does give the platforming and the traversal of the game a very different feel. Especially as you start to mix that in with some of the other, you know, running on houses and buildings and man-made structures. Sometimes those kind of combine in interesting ways. And the setting is just glorious. I mean, this place, this, you know, this colonial American, landscape that they provide is just so awesome. And again, it's just not a kind of place I've ever been in a video game before. And, you know, there's an impressive amount of storytelling that's just in the environment, and it's just in the minor characters who, you know, they don't give you missions or anything. They're just kind of hanging around. You can go talk to them or just see them living their lives. And it's just really cool. You know, I mean, it just gives you an experience that you haven't had before. And I think the game deserves a lot of credit. You know, there certainly are missions that are kind of janky and don't work that well, but I'll also say, you know, I'm playing this game several months after it first came out. I've downloaded multiple patches on the Wii U version. So a lot of the technical problems that you probably read about back in October and November, I think a lot of those have been cleaned up, because I really didn't have any kind of major bugs or anything like that. And I think they probably have even rebalanced some of the missions, maybe to make them play out better. So if you have any interest in Assassin's Creed 3, you know, now is a good time to play it. They've fixed it up quite a bit, and you can get it for a much lower price. And in the end, I really honestly enjoyed it, much more than I was expecting to. And I think it's the best Assassin's Creed that I've played. And I think if I had actually played more than, you know, 3 or 4 hours of it back when we did our list, this would have definitely been in my top five of 2012. So I'm strongly recommending it. I think this game deserves another look by a lot of people. I hope I can convince at least a few people to just try it out. You know, if you've been turned off by bad reviews or, you know, just weird bugs that you've seen on YouTube or whatever, I think this game deserves more credit than that, and it deserves being played. So that's going to wrap up New Business, everybody. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got Retroactive on Mega Man 3.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a feature, Top 10 3DS Games, 2 years on. NWR takes a look at the top 10 games for the 3DS as selected via poll of the staff. No doubt you will think democracy has failed.
And we have review of Injustice, Gods Among Us, by Zach Miller on the Wii U. This is not Mortal Kombat. This is not Mortal Kombat. This is not Mortal Kombat.
This is not Mortal Kombat.
This is totally Mortal Kombat. That's okay. It turns out this is good Mortal Kombat. Not bad Mortal Kombat.
Which would also be Mortal Kombat.
It doesn't have green blood. All right, we have a review mini of Punch-Out for Wii U by Tom Molina. It's Punch-Out. I'm excited, that's part of the name. And of course, this game is great, so put on your boxing gloves and punch enough ethnic stereotypes that it's probably a hate crime.
Oof. That's the virtual console release, of course.
And we have a feature. Best of the Miiverse, Rayman Legends Challenges app by Zach Kaplan. With the launch of the Miiverse for internet browsers, we're inundated with free content. I mean, we are able to show you the best drawings from the Rayman Legends Challenges app Miiverse Plaza. Next week, Funky Bar.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We also have a review revisit for Fluidity Spin Cycle by Johnny, Yi, and Tyler, as edited by Neil, apparently. It's time to get wet. These four take a dive back into the pool to... forget it. NWR takes a second look at Fluidity's 3DS sequel.
It's good. Buy it. It's on sale.
So Guillaume is only slightly damp. He's not fully wet.
I got drizzled on. It's fine.
He's moist.
Lastly, Nintendo World Report Powered Off Issue 5 is out now. I talk about Mega Man and Capcom, how much they hate you. More of that in the next segment.
So this is our monthly magazine, PDF magazine version of NWR, and it's really cool. Definitely check it out. All right, so that is just a sampling of the fantastic original content appearing this week on NintendoWorldReport.com. Head over there right now and find out what else we've been posting since this episode was recorded.
It's just a dribbling of the wonderful Nintendo saliva.
What else we've been posting? But only look at the stuff since this got recorded. Look at nothing else. Look at something else. I'll cut your eyes out. The melon baller.
Retroactive, and just in case you missed it a couple weeks ago, we had a poll asking people whether we should play Mega Man 2 or Mega Man 3, and Mega Man 3 won with nearly two-thirds of the votes. I thought that was pretty shocking. I really expected it to be very, very much down the middle, but Mega Man 3 people thought sounded more interesting, or maybe was just the less discussed game in the series. And so that's the one that we played and that we're going to talk about. I have a bunch of forum quotes, and before we kick off, I just want to say, I don't know how many of these we're going to get to read. It kind of depends on where the discussion takes us, but we had quite a few people coming in the forum thread saying this was their first retroactive, and I love seeing that, and I hope that people found it rewarding and had a good time playing through the game and talking about it in the forums. And also, I think we even had a couple people who said they were playing Mega Man 3 for the first time. And that really warms my heart that we have convinced people to play Mega Man 3. Actually, last week, the reason we recorded a day early last week is that I wanted to go to the movie theater with some friends and see a cut-together couple episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, which they were doing in celebration of a Blu-ray release. And seeing that show from the 90s, I think those episodes actually were from 1990 or 1991, which is almost exactly when Mega Man 3 came out. So seeing those episodes in a movie theater and then coming home and playing Mega Man 3 could not have been a more nostalgic evening for me. And it was a real pleasure for me to go back to this game. And I'll say a little more about that in a minute, but I know a lot of people were talking about nostalgia, but also comparing their memories of playing it as a child with the experience now. And that's kind of where I thought we would start, maybe, is I wanted to ask you guys, since we've all played this game before to some extent, how would you compare your memories or your nostalgia for the game with playing it again now?
I was a hard ass as a kid, apparently.
Yeah, so was I.
Because I remember at a certain point I was able to wreck this game. And I mean, that's sort of the evolution of my Mega Man playing style, is that every game I got to a point where I could just decimate it with just complete and utter disregard for the creator's well-being.
Yeah, I mean, they lend themselves to that, but it's the question of how much time you want to put in to attain that level of mastery.
Yeah,
right.
And it doesn't.
It's a skill-based game.
Yeah, it is, but it doesn't always feel like the skills carry over from one game to the next, because there's a certain amount of just, like, you have to remember all of this crap. And
there's also new mechanics and new weapons and new enemy patterns, and the games are, I wouldn't say repetitive, then they're formulaic, but they're not repetitive. They are different.
Is this the first one where you had the? I'm not sure. Did they ever give it a name in this game? The down A boost.
The slide. Yes, this was – so Mega Man 3, just a quick history lesson. You know, Mega Man 2 kind of revived the franchise, saved the franchise, became a big hit. But mechanically, Mega Man 2 is not that different from the first one. They got rid of the score counter and the points drops.
Right.
Because the first game, it had little power-ups that would drop down. All they did was increase your score, which didn't do anything. It was a very arcadey kind of experience. And Mega Man 2 increased it from 6 to 8 boss battles, which is now the standard, of course. And it added energy tanks. And the only other kind of twist was that they had the items that you would unlock by beating certain bosses. And they let you ride, like an elevator, kind of ride up a wall. Or it was like a rocket sled. You'd get on it and it would just carry you straight across the screen for a really long way. So it was that kind of thing. Mega Man 3 was mechanically quite different. They added the slide, which was, a topic of some discussion we might get into later, but that was a pretty big deal. They added the mystery tanks, which I think went away after a couple games.
Yeah, they're not around anymore. And they don't really make a lot of sense, because just give me the item. I mean, nothing ever pops out of them. You just go, oh my god!
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But they added Proto Man, who was the first kind of, ambiguous character in terms of his allegiances and what is he doing here and why is he just kind of showing up randomly. Really the first mini-boss. I don't think Mega Man 2 really had mini-bosses in the way that this game does. And then they added Rush, which was kind of an adaptation of the devices for Mega Man 2, but they had now characterized it and made it into your robotic dog Buddy, which is obviously, way better than these kind of numbered gadgets that you have in your inventory. So those are the main, kind of additions and revisions to Mega Man 3 over the original.
Yeah, and the my experience with Mega Man as a kid was more like I had Mega Man 3 on the Game Boy. So, like, while certain bosses were familiar, and I listening to some of this music was definitely a nostalgic experience. I think that only 4 bosses in the Game Boy game were from Mega Man 3 on the NES: Snake Man, Shadow Man, Spark Man, and Gemini Man.
Yeah,
Gemini Man, and the other 4 were from Mega Man 4 on the NES. So yeah, like it's a little bit weird. It's kind of a remix
because it was developed later than the.
Because you have the Mega Buster in the Game Boy version.
Oh, you mean the Charge Shot?
Right,
the Charge Shot. Yeah,
it's always been the Mega Buster.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think they called it Arm Cannon in the original instruction manual.
It's the Buster.
Okay.
It's the Mega Buster. It always has been. It's just they added the charge function in Mega Man 4,
right,
which some people hate. I mean, I always liked it, but some people think it actually kind of ruins the pace of the game.
I don't know. That seems
And then in Mega Man X, they kind of take it to the nth degree.
In Mega Man X, it becomes awesome.
You can charge it 5 levels, and then you can, like...
He goes Super Saiyan.
All your sub-weapons, and yeah, you can go Super Saiyan.
Yeah. It's
then they pull off your monkey tail, and...
So when does the... I want to say it's 4 the Charge Shot first shows up.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, really, after 4... It becomes a. I mean, they stopped really adding a lot of this crazy stuff until much later. So
yeah, they kind of settled down on the mechanics a lot after 4.
Yeah, it's weird playing 3 right now because I mean, most of my recent Mega Man stuff has been with the X series, which I absolutely adore beyond what my feelings for the mainline series are. And these games feel super fucking slow compared to the X series, which is just like, I'm going to run at you really fast, and shit's going to blow up everywhere, and you're going to need to jump really long distances and slide boost all the time, and occasionally shit's just going to blow up for no reason. This game is like, no, you're going to really slowly platform because something's going to jump out and hit you in the head and knock you off the platform.
Yeah, it's strange in that deliberate. Mega Man X has not only, like, it's the faster action, it has faster action, but also it has more exploration. Like, it has both.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, what's funny is this game, 3, is really hard. Like, I'm struggling with this game mightily, which I thought, all right, I'll sit down with this game, I'll spend an hour, I'll get my butt kicked, and I'll be okay. No.
Yeah, it's only an hour long if you actually know what you're doing.
It has been. So I think in the first night, which was about 3-ish hours, I guess, I had probably cleared 3 or 4 enemies at that point, and I was just utterly being frustrated by Shadow Man stage to the point where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I just can't.
That's it. It's a tough, probably the toughest stage of the main 8 levels.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, to me, some of the stages are kind of what I find difficult and what other people find difficult can vary quite a bit. I mean, I found that Sparkman stage was just a nightmare for me. I don't know why.
Really?
It was just something about it, and I think there was like one jump that just completely befuddled me.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I think Hardman's level is pretty hard, but pretty tough, but some of that is there's a bit of cheapness in Hardman's level that you don't get out of all the other levels. Like, there's that place where there's a big rock platform, very tall, right in the middle of the screen, and there's a, you know, one of those the guys with the chain, ball and chain on top, whatever they're called, and the only way to get up there is to use Rush, but in the process of using Rush, there's, I mean, once
he'll
you
knock
get
right
up
back
there,
up.
Yeah, so it's almost impossible to get up there and kill that enemy without getting hit. And so what I would usually do is time my jump so I get up there in between his attacks, and then I would just run through the enemy and get to the other side.
Yeah, the Hammer Joe there is kind of a pain in the butt.
Hammer Joe.
That's his name, yeah. All those generic green enemies with the one eye, they're all something Joe.
Yeah.
That level, actually, right after you cleared that, there's a section of platforming where these things come down and hit you and knock you off. That goes on for seemingly forever.
Oh, the bees?
Yeah, the bees. Yeah. The bees are the worst, because you can't, I mean, you almost can't avoid getting hit by them.
Yeah, you just seem to get knocked around a lot. There's just a lot of knocking around, like, you know, in 2, like, I played through 2, and, I mean, you know, the thing is, I came into 3, and I was like, yeah, you know, I'll play through, you know, I'll go around, I'll play, you know, each boss, and, you know, eventually I'll break through on every one of them. Nope. 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 It's like, wow. I'm going to have to just pick one and just attack it.
That's pretty much what you have to do. You just have to get to the point where the level is no longer, I mean, you're not thinking, you're just acting.
But John, would you say that, you know, over your lifetime, you've played 2 a lot more than 3?
Yeah, absolutely.
See, I don't think 2 is necessarily an easier game than 3.
See, I
think it's just most people have played 2 more than 3, familiar, and you can just blast through it.
That's the thing, though. I think with 2, it's much easier to get to the boss. Yeah. It's just,
I agree with that.
Well, that's the thing. In 3, I found, like, holy crap. I mean, halfway through, I was just getting pummeled. Well, the thing is, what I always found was that I would get about halfway through, and by that point, I would be just hanging on.
Yeah.
So by the time I actually got 2, like, I would have like three like, you know, points of health left, and I could get to the boss, but by the time I got there, I would just get one shot.
Yeah, I mean, to me,
and that didn't happen in 2.
To me, what the big difference between 2 and 3 is 3's levels feel a bit longer, and there's so few checkpoints that
I do think they are longer. Yeah.
That you can meet utter disaster simply because there's no checkpoint where there should be one.
Yeah, you really have to step, like, you can't just blast through them. Like, in 2, you know, there's some areas where you'll get hung up, right? But typically you can avoid them. You know, you can use a device and get across, like, you know, some of the ones where the blocks, you know, fall away or whatever, you can just, you know, use a device and get across it or something like that. But there's no real brick wall spots. But in 3, there's brick wall spots where you're just like, wow.
I actually played Mega Man 2 last week, and I actually thought that Mega Man 3 has less unfair levels. Like, I thought it was actually easier to get through some of, like, basically any, like, vacuum cube parts, you know, like the...
Yeah.
Those
are generally pretty easy in this game.
Yeah. Yeah, and I found that a relief, really. And, like, because
like,
they're...
Like, Heatman's level, for the disappearing blocks in Heatman's level in 2 are just asinine. And then, like, Airman's level, where you're standing on the big goat faces with the horns that come up and down, and there's enemy, you know, eggs being dropped all over it. That stage is fucked up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Whereas in this game, is, like, you basically, when there's the vacuum cubes, they just, you can basically see the whole thing before you attempt to cross it, usually. Like, you see where you're going.
Right.
And that was not always the case in Mega Man 2. Sometimes, like, at some point you were doing, like, leaps of faith, basically.
Right.
See, to me, that was never really the issue. I mean, there's stuff in, like, Needle Man stage, where those things that come down from the ceiling and you have to slide and time it just right where it just feels like there's no chance you won't get hit by this. it's going to hit you. Just accept it and move on with your life.
Actually, on those, I think there is almost always a way to get through those without getting hit, I think. But sometimes the strategy comes down to edging the screen, because you can change the synchronization of the needles as they come down.
That's just utter bullshittery.
There's more than one in a row, you know, depending on how much of it is on the screen, you can kind of control and you can kind of resynchronize them in a way. You know, you would have to experiment a lot to learn how to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about that is they put it, that shit doesn't really show up in the level until right before you get to Needle Man. It's like, these things show up and then his door. Mm-hmm. And you can lose easily half your life dealing with those stupid things.
Yeah.
I find them really easy, but I have a lot of muscle memory because this is the first Mega Man game that I owned. I had rented 1 and 2 a lot, and I loved them, especially 2. But 3 was, you know, by that time I was already a fan. So when 3 came out in 1990, I got it. I don't remember if I bought it with my own money or if it was a gift. But I owned it, and so I played the ever-loving shit out of this game, and I knew it backwards and forwards. Now, a little rusty, you know, it's like a lot of times I was surprised by how much I remembered of the levels and also how little I remembered of the levels. It was just this constant kind of shock at, you know, just how partial my memory of the game is. And yet there are levels where I would do things, I'd get to the other side of the room and I'd say, how did I know how to do that? Like, I don't consciously remember how to get through that room, but on some subliminal level, I still can do it. I still have the skills, and I just kind of went through it, you know, I just did it like almost on autopilot, because I used to play those levels so many times as a kid.
So did you guys go after the Doc Robot levels?
I attempted them. I have a great forum quote here from Klex Yoshi, and if you haven't been to the forum thread, it's worth going for this post alone, not to mention many other wonderful comments that people dropped in there, but Klex Yoshi wrote a fucking book about Mega Man 3 in his post, and it was hard to pick just one section to pull out of here, because he's clearly an absolute expert on this game. But also gave a really good critical analysis of it, all the things he likes and things he doesn't. So on the Doc Robot topic, this is the quote that I pulled out. It says, Doc Robot was a good idea in concept. Bring back 8 enemies that resonate with those who picked up our huge smash hit game, Mega Man 2, as a set of bosses to face after you beat the new set of Robot Masters. Because we know that the player
toughed
out sounds good.
Because we know that the player has toughed out the Robot Master stages already, we can make these stages more difficult and put in more instances of mandatory use of the travel items and weapons. It all sounds great, but the truth of the matter is that they recycle stage themes from the originals, which starts to set in the only instance I can think of in the classic series where fatigue ever really set in from having to play through stages that use similar tile sets, enemies, and the same music from Spark, Shadow, Needle, and Gemini Man stages. Add in the fact that because there are 2 bosses to these stages with stretches of stage in between each boss, these stages are long. They also don't have very many checkpoints. there are no checkpoints between the beginning of a Doc Robot stage and the first Doc Robot in said stage.
Well, and it's not even that. There's no checkpoints.
And that's really critical.
There's no checkpoints between the beginning of the stage and the end of the first Doc Robot. If you die fighting Doc Robot, whoosh, back to the beginning.
Right.
Which is brutal.
Yeah, it's harsh.
And these stages are fucking horrendously difficult.
It's
more difficult than the original versions.
Yeah. So I was taking a crack at those while we were recording earlier, and it's just so fucking hard. I mean, I got through the first half of Metal Man stage.
Metal Man?
Metal Man. I fought Metal Man. I can't remember. He's in Sparkman stage. Yeah. And it was the dumbest level I've ever seen. I mean, it's brutal. And then they're like, oh yeah, and you're not going to get any health items. Also, here's fucking Metal Man. It's like, oh great. Awesome. This is fantastic.
And Metal Man's not that hard, though. It wasn't hard in Mega Man 2.
No, but I mean, you're brutalized coming in the door.
Airman, that bastard Airman, can go eat it. Because that was the level. It's Needle Man's stage when you revisit and it's nighttime. And it looks cool, you know, and there's some interesting ideas in the level there. But Airman was just a total bastard in Mega Man 2, and he's way worse in 3.
He's the first boss you face, too. And if you get past him, you still have to get through Crash Man.
Right, which is also a really difficult battle. And the whole stage is just evil. And just the Airman battle, it's a cool idea, I think, to bring back the Mega Man 2 bosses and have you face them. Because, again, now you have the slide. You have totally different weapons. The game has changed. So making you play these old bosses over again means you have to take a new strategy with them. And that is interesting. But the fact that they all look the same, you know, they're all this Doc Robot skull guy, it really takes a lot of the character out of fighting them. And also, it's just really unbalanced, you know. I mean, in Mega Man 2, the only way Airman is anything other than just cheap awfulness is the fact that you can kill him in 4 hits with the Leaf Shield. And it's hard to do, but if you have the Leaf Shield, you can beat him. In this game, he's not nearly that weak to anything, and it's so difficult to get a shot on him, and you can't move when he's using his power. It's just horrible.
Well, I mean, it expects you to use Top Spin against Crash Man. I mean, what the fuck? Nobody can use Top Spin. Top Spin is the worst garbage ever. It stands alone as one of the worst Mega Man powers up until, like, Mega Man X6.
Actually, I had a category of comments just on Top Spin.
It's so bad.
This one comes from Shaman. And I should note that actually Clex Yoshi, our resident expert in the forum thread, actually really appreciates Top Spin and kind of likes that it's difficult to use but very powerful once you learn it.
Oh, it's tremendously powerful, and I know how to use it. It's just not fun.
Yeah, most people in the thread disliked it. And Shaman's quote here is pretty typical, I think. He says, Top Man's power is probably the most frustrating ability this side of the charge kick, which is from 5, considering you never know when it's going to make contact. In the final form of Wily, I spent a good 15 minutes dying repeatedly because I was trying to make the jump from the right platform and land Mega Man on top of Wily's sprite. I finally got the job done when I realized I had to instead land between the giant spike and Wily to actually do some damage. The only other time I actually managed to get it to work was on the Heat Man fight. Even Shadow Man, who's weak to Top Spin, had to be beat with Hard Knuckle and his own weapon. I think Shaman's post here actually illustrates why people don't know how to use Top Spin. Because the thing about a top, if you think about, you know, spinning an actual top on a table, is that it, you know, if it damages something, it's going to do it from the side. It's going to bounce. It's tops bounce off of things because they're spinning. So if you're trying to land on top of an enemy while you use Top Spin, you will take damage and you will not hurt it. You have to jump at it and hit it and use the power in midair and attack something from the side.
It's so difficult to pull off.
You're right. The timing is brutal.
Especially,
it's really hard to use.
Especially against, you know, the robot bosses like Shadow Man.
Yeah. I mean, because they're fast. Because Shadow Man in particular jumps all over like a monkey. So.
Yeah, you're basically trying to make him jump into you when you use it. And you still take damage when you do it. He's going to hit you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never been able to use Top Spin without damaging myself. So it's really like you do need your full bar of health when you don't really know what you're doing.
Yeah. I pulled it off. I think I was almost dead. And he didn't hit me any other besides when he hit me when I hit him. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard. It's a hard game.
Yeah.
Oh.
I remember being a kid and getting to Wily, and, you know, I didn't have game facts or anything back then, so I'm figuring out most of this shit as I go on my own, maybe with a friend there, and we're kind of talking it out and trying to figure out, you know, what to do. But I remember getting to Wily for the first time as a kid, which, you know, you can imagine without save states and everything, and, you know, you didn't have a repository of passwords. This was a real feat to get that far.
Yeah.
And I remember,
and everything is so high stakes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is the end.
And, yep. It's like, this is it. We have one life. It's now or never. It'll take us hours to get back to where we are.
Exactly. It would. And I remember standing on that platform and thinking, how am I supposed to hurt him? And I see, you know, they do a good job in the artwork for that battle, because it looks like, you know, he's like in this glass bubble inside Gamma's head. But you can see in the artwork, it looks like there's an entrance on the top, you know, even though it's in profile. It looks like that's how his little UFO got in there. And so it kind of gives you a hint, maybe you could attack him from above. And I thought, wait, how am I supposed to do that? Like, if you shoot magnet missiles at them, they won't home in. You know, there's none of the your snake weapon won't go far enough to get to them, or else that would have been a way, because they kind of arc in. So you could have maybe tried to lob some of those in, but they won't go far enough. And I'm thinking, how am I supposed to get something from above? And I was like, wait a minute, what about that power I never use and that I hate? What if he is weak to, of all things, what if he is weak to Top Spin? And you can kill him in one hit with Top Spin.
Yeah.
You have to hit it, you have to go in at just the right angle and use it at just the right time. But I figured that out on my own, and I did it, and it worked, and I beat the game, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
So already,
I love Top Spin.
already as a kid, you had an inkling that the developers of this game hated you.
No, I thought, this is a weapon that clearly most people are not going to use throughout the game, right? It's so conditional and so difficult to use, and I love the idea that at the very end of the game, they're going to say, look, you cannot get through this whole game ignoring one of the 8 weapons we gave you. You're going to have to figure out when to use it and how to use it, and now is the time. And it pays off. I think it's great. That they do that. I think it's a wonderful way to end that game.
It's so brutal, though, because the game's just like, okay, here you go. This is the skill you now have to deal with. And by the way, it's awful. By the way, it's the worst power in Mega Man history.
Yeah, that's what I love about the series, though, the fact that it encourages you to just kind of mess around.
I mean, it's basically on the verge of some of the dumb shit that they gave Zero in the first game you could actually play as him. Where they're like, it's not really a power because we can't figure out how to make swords shoot ice. Actually, a sword does shoot ice. Can't figure out how to make a electric-themed sword, so instead you're going to go ahead and... does that too. Regardless, it's like, this skill actually just makes you double jump. It's like, wait, I beat a boss that double jump? Fuck you! I mean, if you played the previous two games, it feels particularly incongruent with what you've been dealing with for the last 6 plus 8 plus 7 bosses. I mean, it's just a very strange feeling to play it with it.
You mean to play Wily?
No, to use that one power.
It's a melee attack in a Mega Man game.
It's pretty bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
This character has a gun built into his arm. So, you know, the fact that they gave him a melee attack was kind of a big deal, you know, and it feels weird to play the game that way. But I appreciate the boldness.
Now, I want to get away from the game proper for a second. Am I the only one who played, like, the remixed version on the PlayStation 2 or GameCube collection?
I did not play it on GameCube Collection. I have the GameCube Collection.
I have played the GameCube Collection version of
it. I actually decided I'm going to try this Navi mode thing on the PlayStation 2.
Mm.
At the same time, I was also playing through the game on the 3DS. So I actually beat the game twice over the last week.
Nice.
But I was playing on easy, because you can select the difficulty on the PlayStation 2.
because it has difficulty settings.
Yeah, and a couple of things, it's just like, it's got new music. The new music is terrible for the most part. Like the classic,
yep.
The classic versions are so much better. Also, another observation, we had really, really, really low standards for emulation back in the day.
Like, oh no, I knew that emulation was terrible. I mean, I was fully aware how bad that emulator was.
Yeah, like the colors aren't right. Everything is just too flashy, you know. And I guess one of the good things is that you don't get the slowdown.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that the Wii U version, the Wii emulator, actually has much more slowdown because they deliberately left it in.
Yeah, but it's
yeah,
more
it
authentic.
Have more than the
right?
original. It's just accurate.
Right. Yeah,
it
has, yeah. It has more.
Game has hella slowdown.
It does.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
They try to do
I
a
like
lot.
The
try
accuracy.
To throw a lot at you.
Right? Yeah, I really like the accuracy of the emulation.
I don't mind the slowdown being gone, but some of the other stuff in the GameCube version is frustrating.
Well, yeah. Before we move on, I just want to read this comment from Jonky Kong, which is one of the great forum names I've ever heard. And this person said, is it just me or is the slowdown really bad in this game? I remember it being a frequent thing in NES games, but never to this degree. I just tried defeating the second Dark Master in the Sparkman level. I think it's Quickman? Using the Snake Search weapon. And between all the snakes and Quickman's boomerangs, the entire battle was in slow motion.
still about the Navi mode though. Like you get tips from Proto Man, and they are just the most useless tips you've ever heard. You know, like and sometimes like it's kind of semi angrish. So I'm not sure like if you know like they really made it through localization. Like if it was that way.
Oh
in the
no,
Japanese
that game
version.
Was localized in Japan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, actually, oh no, yeah, I watched the credits. It was localized in Japan. There was
no,
not
I know,
one American
I know it
name.
Was, yes.
and you'll get like, I don't know, he'll tell you how to defeat the Hammer Joes, right? Like, oh, it's much easier when you shoot from the ladder. And then, like, the next, Hammer Joe that you meet, use the ladder shot, or the ladder attack. You know, it just assumes that you've read the previous message, right? And it's just like, ladder attack? What are you talking about? It's what a lame name.
Hit him with the ladder!
And there was actually a shot where like he said, like, watch out for the ceiling. Enemies will come down from the ceiling. Oh, okay. Like, it's, I don't know. Like, it's really, like, it was not useful at all. And
I remember... Protoman's kind of a weird character in this game because in the original they don't really do much with him.
No.
He shows up the first time with this strange whistling song. And I remember the first time I actually remember playing this game when he shows up. I go, "Who the fuck are you?" And then just getting trounced by him because he experiences nothing of what we would call knockback.
Yeah.
He's just
a machine. He is RoboCop. He just keeps moving forward no matter how many times you shoot him.
I mean, he lets you basically just gun him in the back as much as you want. It just he just doesn't care. And then he warps off. I'm like, you bastard, get back here. and I remember playing it this time and hearing his really short theme, which is actually really kind of one of the more well-regarded pieces of music in the game. I think probably just because the fact that it's, oh god, this bastard's back. And he's just showing up and I'm like, what? 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 And then, I can't remember what stage it is, but there's a stage where he doesn't fight you. He just shows up, clears out the barrier and goes away.
Yeah, that's Gemini, man. Yeah.
And that was the first one I played this. I'm like, let's go bit. The fuck?
I love the musical cue and, I wonder if you guys thought about this, but it kind of made me think of like a spaghetti western.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, it is. It's totally that. He's got a cape, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Yeah, he even has that kind of sash, or I don't think it's a cape. I think it's more of a sash, but
yeah.
You know, he's definitely the archetype for Zero, the character from, from the Mega Man X series. But yeah, I mean, again, as a child, not knowing very much about, you know, the background of this game, I mean, the game has almost no story until the very, very end of the game. And all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, there's cutscenes?
Right.
Who is Gamma? What are you talking about? You know, all this stuff just kind of happens at the very end. But you know, he is this character who appears, he kind of fights you, but he kind of ignores you also, like you said, you know, he's very stoic and he doesn't seem to care whether right. you fight him or not. And then in one level, it seems like he helps you, you know, because there's this thing in your way and he blows it up so you can keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is going on? It's all very mysterious. And then at the very end of the game, when you watch the credits, you find out that he is Mega Man's brother. He was the prototype. He was the first robot that, that Dr. Light made.
Dr. Wright,
again, just to go back to Star Trek The Next Generation, very much like Lore, made by Dr. Soon. But, you know, it's a really cool bit of character development that from a series where you would not expect any character development at all.
And if you look at it, you realize all the Joes are based on his model. All the Joes are basically mass-produced protomans.
Oh, that's cool.
So okay. Especially when you get to – I can't remember if Sniper Joe show up in this game or not. But they look just like him, but they're green and only have a little Cyclops eye. It's weird for him just to show up and then go away. But that shit happens – like at this point, I'm just numb to it because that shit happens the entire Mega Man series. They'll create a character whose only purpose is to just troll you slightly as he shows up, does something relatively detrimental to the overall task, and then goes away like he didn't do anything wrong.
Well, this started with Proto Man.
Yeah.
You know? And I think, actually, if we're being serious here, I don't know that Proto Man was ever really meant to be a major story conceit. I think the main reason he's in there is because he's perfect for practicing your slide.
Yes.
Which was the big new mechanic in the game. Because he does that kind of arcing jump, and you know, the best way to avoid getting hit by him is it almost forces you to learn how to use the slide and to use it well.
Or just outgun him.
So it serves an important purpose in that way.
My strategy for beating him usually is if necessary, take the hit, but take it in such a way that he doesn't get to hit me twice on a pass.
Yeah, and stay on one side because he goes all the way over, so you can just sit there and keep pelting him.
Right. You'll lose about a quarter of your health, and then you just hope you're not standing where he blows up the floor.
Yep.
Because that shit hurts.
It does?
Does it?
I believe it does, yeah.
I'm not so sure about that.
I'm pretty certain it does.
Didn't know about that. But if you drop immediately, you may not get any kind of power-up. He leaves, so...
I don't know that he leaves. I don't think I've ever had him leave one.
I think it's random. I think he can.
Mysterious individual.
This game is. Basically never drops power-ups. I mean,
yeah,
that's
another thing I noticed too. I mean, I was just
they
like,
are really rare.
I was just like, I'm gonna sit here and farm. Sure, I've got my butt kicked, but I'm fine. Nothing.
Nothing's coming. Nothing's coming, bro.
Yep.
Yeah, farming is not a very effective tactic. I mean, compared to like Mega Man X, where you can farm 9 extra lives in the span of about 45 seconds on some levels.
Yeah.
It's pretty jarring, you know? I mean, this game's pretty stingy with weapon, especially in the Wily stages, weapon power can become very precious.
Yeah.
And in most stages, I think just life is very precious.
Well, yeah,
life energy.
If you're coming from the X series, E-tanks aren't reusable.
Right.
In those games, you get them and then you fill them up. This game doesn't really have collectible upgrades. E-tanks are really all there is. And they're basically just like a free full health power. I think there's 9 in the game or something like that. And when I got to Wily, I think I got to Wily stage with 6, I think. Which to me was like the greatest accomplishment. I'm like, yeah, 6 of these. I'm gonna fuck. And then I decided, well, I'll try the special stages, and that was a terrible decision. So I'm down to like 2, and I haven't even attempted the castle yet. It's going swimmingly.
What are we talking about? The special stages?
The Dr. Robot.
Doc Robot.
Yeah.
Are those supposed to be optional or what?
No, they're not optional.
Oh, okay.
No, but you can go after the, I can't remember what I was trying to say now. Regardless.
You might have been using passwords or something. I mean, for me, actually, I was getting stuck on I'd beat 2, I think, of the Doc Robot stages, but in the process had used all my energy tanks, had gotten really frustrated, and the other 2 were just driving me crazy. And I was like, I really want to beat this in time for Retroactive. So last night, I was like, screw it. I'm putting in a password. You know,
nice.
I mean, I used to do this stuff as a kid, too. You know, you had Nintendo Power, and you'd put in the... you know, the A6 red to get 9 energy tanks at the start of the game, or you'd use a password, just go straight to Wily's Castle. And the funny thing is, I went to Wily's Castle and easily beat the rest of the game. like in a span of 30 minutes, plowed through the rest of it, you know, yeah, and just this, did awesome.
Yeah, the stages are really short, and the bosses in Wily's Castle are really not that hard. Like, they've right. all got one weapon that they're extremely vulnerable to.
Yeah. And the rock monster is the hardest one, and he's recycled from the first game.
Yep.
But
the yellow devil.
The difference, yeah, the yellow devil. But in this game, the difference is you have a slide.
Yeah.
So it's actually much easier to avoid some of his attacks than it was in the first game. And so again, I kind of appreciate that they brought him back, because you end up playing him in a very different way than you did. But actually, on the subject of Wily's Castle, this was another popular topic, and we have a quote from another appropriately named forum user, Smeet Bass.
Right? Nice.
What a total 180 from the rest of the game. Boring levels and the bosses were so unforgettable. This is about Wily's Castle again. What was that first boss? Then you have three that are remakes from bosses from Mega Man 1. What a cheap thing to do. Recycle everything they did two games prior. Then when you get to Wily, neither form was any challenge. Rush Jed on the first form and he's toast. On the final form, you Shadow Blades under him where he can't hit you. Then one top spin in the middle and you win? Disappointing. Then they introduced cutscenes, which were cool at the time, but at 10 years old, I didn't care.
Nice.
So that meant the world. I was 10 years old when I played this, and it meant the world to me. But
well, they were so rare, right? Like, you would be like, oh my god, this is mind-blowing.
Yeah. Wait, there's story in this game?
What?
Awesome.
What? It's like a cartoon.
The game. No, but seriously, speaking of cartoons, like, the enemies are so imaginative and so yeah. out of the cartoon. Like, what is that thing? Like, is that springy robot, like, does it carry a broom? Like, that pole
no, it's
jump?
A pogo stick.
It's a pogo stick, yeah.
Oh, okay. Like, no, it just pulls, no, pole jumps over you and then runs back at you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I think it is a push broom. I think he's got a push broom.
I think it's supposed to be a push broom, yeah.
Yeah, it's a push broom, yeah. I thought you were talking about Rush from it, though. Yeah, it's a push broom. And then it can hit you with it, which seems weird because you're made of fucking metal.
Yeah.
But he's a really...
He jumps over your head and then runs back across.
Yeah. He's a really
just a great
so you need pattern. You need really, really good timing to hit the broom, which sometimes yields an item, and then, like, turn around and maybe jump over him and attack him from the back or... You know, mm-hmm. I don't think it's actually possible to be fast enough to kill it before it returns and, you know, hits you. But
he's
yeah, like,
a really, really good just thing to practice timing against.
Yeah, yeah, but like all the enemies are have that kind of like weird, you know, cartoony quality to them. I found like more so than in the previous games. And
yeah, there's the weird cats in Top Man stage.
Yeah.
That throw balls of
and that have like
energy
lice
yarn at you
that
and
jump
then,
at you.
No, they're fleas.
Fleas,
they're
right?
Fleas.
Yeah.
They launch fleas at you that are right. a total pain in the ass to kill.
Hmm. And
but the cat is so well animated. I mean, it just looks fantastic. Mm-hmm.
But
the
perhaps
cat,
like,
the cat is when the game really gets into the weird, weird, weird zone because
well,
it throws fleas and balls of yarn at you.
Yeah. Exactly. What about the grenades that run at you though? Would that fly today?
Maybe not today, but in the design aesthetic that evil genius Dr. Wily employs, grenade monsters, I can kind of understand, but what the fuck possessed him to make giant cats?
Yeah. Maybe he just likes
cats.
It's
not really in his wheelhouse.
I mean, he's a doctor, kind of like Dr. Evil, maybe?
No, but like these are designs from Dr. Light, right? And
Wily
just corrupts
some of them.
Them.
I think, in general, the idea is that Dr. Light designs all the bosses, but then Dr. Wily corrupts them, and I think Dr. Wily designs most of the lesser enemies that you fight.
Mm. Yeah, I think that shifts later, where Wily builds bosses, and then actually in Mega Man 4, someone else is building the bosses.
Oh, Dr. Cossack?
Yeah, I mean...
But he's being brainwashed by Dr. Wily.
Which makes no sense, because last time I checked, Dr. Wily can't brainwash people, but whatever.
It's well, have you seen those eyebrows, though?
Yeah,
I mean, you could definitely be hypnotized by those. Yeah,
they're very convincing.
Yeah,
yeah. It's. I mean, coming from way down the road in the series now, it feels very restrictive playing this game. I mean, things that don't show up for a long time, like wall kick, are just like, wow, these levels are really vertical, but you can't do anything about it. I remember the first time I stepped into Hardman stage, and you get to the part where you have to use the rush jump, going, the fuck do I do here? I'm like, right, oh, yeah. Right, the rush jump. Oh my
yeah,
God.
But I, it's like, that was also in Mega Man 1 and 2.
No. Yeah, but I haven't played those games in a while. Right. It was just, you know, my brain's so conditioned having, you know, played these games for so long to just, you know, go, all right, I can just climb right up this thing. It'll be fun. Oh, no, I can't. Okay. There's a guy up there throwing Hammer Joes, and I'm stuck down here yelling at him. Great. And it took me a good minute to remember how to use the rush jump because it's not super clear because you scroll through your menu options down there. It's a very rough game. I mean, it's got things in there where you're like, wow, this is really early game design. Mm-hmm. And it makes some of the bullshit the game does with like the insta-kills where it's just like, oh, by the way, there's an enemy that's going to hit you right as you jump across this chasm. So you have to edge up a little bit to make him come out and then jump.
Yeah.
It makes that stuff seem more obnoxious.
Yeah, there's a lot of sit back and observe to this game. Really more than it probably more than they intended.
The tempura shrimp thing. / clouds.
No, it's not a bad thing. It's just
one of the worst parts of the game for me.
So I like that stuff, and this was a popular topic on the forum, so I've got a couple comments I want to make. Marty wrote, "A little patience goes a long way, and with a few exceptions, it's far safer and saner to back up a little bit, assess where you need to land, wait for a safe opportunity, and then continue. Charging ahead and relying on reflexes rarely pays off, and often lends itself to quick, annoying deaths. Once I got used to the idea that Mega Man is pretty weak, delicate, and immobile, I was able to lock into a method for clearing stages pretty easily." And actually, another good one here, just in terms of, and I think, James, this would disagree with your stance that this is kind of a primitive game design. Because again, this is the third game in the series. They've learned a lot at this point. Jordan Elek wrote, "This game is pretty good at providing iterative learning opportunities. After a few tries at a level, I've been able to make it to the end without any damage, which means I've learned how to properly navigate the level. This is the same kind of experience I had with Dark Souls, and since this is the first Mega Man game I've replayed since finishing Dark Souls, I feel like I'm extra prepared for this type of challenge. I notice level design in ways I wouldn't have before, like when an enemy is first introduced in such a way that I can easily see how it behaves without putting me in an overly dangerous position."
No, I understand that the level...
Now, that sounds sophisticated to me, and I agree with that assessment
that's
for the
not,
most part.
But that's not what I'm talking about as the stuff that's primitive. I'm talking about just things like managing the menu. Just the stuff that... how to get to your powers. The fact that the game doesn't use a select button to let you scroll through stuff. I mean, really simple stuff they could have done.
They did improve it from 2, for sure.
They did.
I mean, but I don't know. I don't know if they necessarily made it any better with having the menu pop up from the bottom of the screen.
That's kind of
I mean, that's the thing, because that actually makes it sort of slower and more difficult to go through it.
Well, because you have to page back and forth. But I would say the good thing is you can actually see most of the screen even with the menu up. And in 2, that's a problem, because when you pull up the menu to change powers, it covers up the whole screen and you can't even see what you were doing.
It's pretty obnoxious. Definitely too.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm actually okay with that though, if I can just see all my powers with something to tell me what they are too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times the abbreviation is not super helpful. You have to kind of mouse over to it to see what the icon is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be nice if it just put icons there for each one on the screen. It's just like, okay, I can see it. I'm with that one.
Mm-hmm. They did that eventually.
They did. Know? They did it in 5. And it works out really well, because you can just say, oh, it's that. Okay, I'm going to go over here and use it.
Yeah. Now, I did appreciate the fact that you climb a lot faster than you do in 2. I noticed that right away. Yeah, you climb a lot faster, because I mean, I played them.
The ladders are super slow.
Back to back, like in 2, you take forever to climb up. It just takes forever, but it's really, really crisp in 3, which I noticed right away. I'm like, thank God, climbing ladders takes forever.
long. The ladder climbing in 2 and 1 is really hellacious.
Yeah.
And in fact, I want to say in 9. In 9 and 10, the ladder climbing's back to being kind of slow.
That's weird.
It's just like, oh, fuck this.
Mega Man 9 was based on Mega Man 2, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So that kind of makes sense.
I think they don't have to be that devoted.
Yeah, it's true Mega Man 9 had, like, a slowdown mode, right?
Yeah, where it instituted artificial slowdown.
Yeah.
which is bizarre.
That is really, really faithful.
I really, really want my game to have bad slowdown. Yeah. Done.
I do actually think I think you actually fall faster in Mega Man 3 as well. Because I know there were two things. I believe it's the speed at which you fall is a lot faster in Mega Man 3.
Yeah, it is.
I can believe that.
The start of Shadow Man stage, I think, where you fall.
Yeah, it's a lot quicker.
You're down three screens in a couple seconds.
Yep.
Yeah, compare that to like Quick Man stage.
Where there's like half gravity.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So we have not talked about the music, and before we wrap up, I think it's absolutely imperative that we discuss the music of the game a bit. I mean, in terms of nostalgia, there's no stronger factor for me. I mean, I turn on the title screen and I'm, 8 years old all over again. And actually, last night after I beat the game, as with a lot of old NES games, especially Mega Man games, after the credits roll, you just kind of get this frozen screen of, just the character and the title. Maybe it says thank you or presented by Capcom. And the music just loops infinitely. And this is a song that you haven't heard before. It's only for the final credits. And it's an amazing song. And I left my 3DS open for like 10 minutes just to listen to the music while I did other things. And I actually created a restore point there so I can go and listen to the music anytime I want to.
So
it's that good.
Briefly, the save spots in the 3DS version, are they useful? Because, I mean, I played it on the Wii. I didn't have access to them.
Oh, you mean like
the save states? I kind of just use it as a...
Yeah, save states.
I kind of use it as just a convenient password feature rather than writing down passwords and dealing with all that. I just made a state every time I beat a boss and I got back to the stage select. I would just make a state, just so I could go back to that if I needed to.
That's typically what I would do if there was something... Or if there was, like, something really, really dumb right before the boss... That I was just like, I just don't want to sit here and do this over and over again pointlessly.
That's what I would love to have.
Like, it was very nice where I was just like, wow, that's a real pain in the ass. Like, not even really so much from a cheating standpoint, even though technically it kind of is cheating. It's just an area where I'm just like, I know that in games of this era, they did stuff just to fuck with you and just make it unbelievably hard. And back then I had a ton of time to go through this shit, but now I don't, so I don't want to. So I would just
I think that the save states kind of... I could not stop myself from using them, and I think it kind of ruined the experience for me. Because I just... on the Wii, I beat Castlevania and Ninja Gaiden, and those felt really good. Like, I felt like I had accomplished something. Here, I played the game twice, but I played on easy on the PlayStation 2, so, it didn't feel like I accomplished anything. And with the save states, like, I thought at first, okay, I'm just going to save before... choosing a level because, I don't want to go through the bullshit of farming for E-tanks, right? That's bullshit.
The first hit is free, Guillaume.
Yeah. That's right.
But, so that was what I told myself. But then I'm like, I better save before this boss because, I need to find its weakness and it's kind of bullshit that I have to play through this level again just to get another shot, So then I started saving before the boss doors. And at some point I was just like, oh shit, this jumping section, like it's, like there's this big pit. I better save here because it's bullshit. I'm going to have to go through all the level again if, something happens. So I just,
but you all,
that's exactly how I was too.
You also played on PS2 where you can't do that.
No, so yeah. Yeah. But
you kind of get a pass.
I don't know. I was playing the easy mode where you get half the damage. And there's also, I think there's a couple of enemies that don't show up when you're playing on easy. So, especially during those difficult platforming sections. So, yeah, I don't feel like I just beat an unbelievably hard game. I feel like I cheated my way through it.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably because it was so hard, I didn't feel bad.
I think you do have to play it again. I think you can play it again right now in hard mode. I think you have to, actually, the hard mode on the GameCube with the fucked up controller. That's the version you need to play.
I
bought this game because I've beat it on the GameCube, but I picked up my WaveBird controller, put the GameCube disc in, and then thought about having to jump with B and said, I can't do it. I put it down. I'm like, all right, Nintendo, you win. Here's $5. Mm. Oh, it's awful, but it is what it is.
To be fair, I mean, it's hard to imagine an ideal control scheme on the GameCube controller, but certainly it would have been better to jump with A and shoot with Y, right?
Yeah, I mean, or let me
or
pick.
B, just Y or B, your choice. You know,
let me pick. Let me pick my control scheme. It's not that difficult. Yeah. I mean, the lack of a deep. I mean, the GameCube has a D-pad, but it has a D-pad.
Yeah, it's it kind is of like the shrunken head of D-pads.
Yeah, so it's not super useful, and using the analog stick isn't great. So, I mean, I was playing it with the Classic Controller Pro, which feels awesome to do this.
Yeah.
It's got a nice grip to it. I could just work through it. I did find that it was, you know, it worked out well. But, yeah, that version's music's kind of screwed up, too.
Really?
To get back on topic of music. A little bit.
Yeah. Because they recorded it, right? And it's on a loop, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's goofy. The whole thing is goofy. That whole demo, or that whole version is really weird.
I think they didn't want to try to emulate the sound chip for NES.
Yeah, like, there's so many things missing. Apparently, like, Mega Man 7, they had trouble emulating the Mode 7.
Mega Man 7 is just, if you've never played it, it's weird.
Right, I mean, but, yeah, like, they just didn't include a big part of the ending because, we can't do this.
You know. It's fine. Nobody will notice. They only paid $50 for this collection completely out of nostalgia.
Yeah, and there was like this controversy because some things that were listed as extras on the GameCube version were not included on the disc because they ran out of space. And everyone was just wondering, how the hell do you run out of space? These are NES games. What the hell? But yeah, like
they're PS1 games.
Yeah.
That's the problem. They're all the anniversary collection is based on the PS1
but who the hell does
Capcom
that?
Capcom only released in Japan.
Yeah. Capcom.
It was a poor choice.
So, I mean, Guillaume, you have to understand, Capcom and the Mega Man franchise, first off, Capcom hates their Mega Man fans. Mm. They hate them. They actively hate their Mega Man fans. And they will sell you the worst version of it just because they can. Just out of spite.
These clowns couldn't even, like, finish the emulation for, like, they couldn't get it right for the Mega Man Game Boy collection. So that
They just didn't release it. They just canned the release.
Maybe that's a kindness, but to be fair,
those
the virtual
games
console
are not
releases,
as bad as people say, in my opinion.
No, I mean, maybe it's a kindness they didn't inflict bad versions of them on us. Mm. But look, the virtual console releases are perfect, so.
I would like, I can't remember, did Mega Man and Bass ever come out on the virtual console?
No, it was never released in America.
Well, it was, but much later.
I don't think it was. I think it was Japan and Europe only.
Shouldn't it be like Mega Man and Bass?
it probably should be, but the problem is that's how everybody says it.
I guess.
Really.
Because it's
Rockman
bass,
and Bass.
Trouble.
It is Bass. Yes.
So yeah, it did come out. Oh, but it only came out on the GBA version. That's right. That was the only version that came out in North America. Yeah, as part of the 15th anniversary. Hmm.
So much later.
Yeah. Well, it's like 2003. I mean, so I played that game, and that game is really, really fun. But yeah, I can't imagine what it would have been like if they tried to emulate it. It would have been just a disaster. You would have started the GameCube, would have gone, no, and caught fire.
We moved on too quickly from the music because it does deserve a lot of credit here, and you know you can argue whether you know which one is the best soundtrack of the series, but I think this is up there.
I think it kicks ass. Like I would have thought maybe it's just a nostalgia for the Game Boy version. Like I heard some version of these compositions before, but Top Man was not on the Game Boy version, and his music kicks ass. It's awesome.
Of the original series, these are some of the best. I think 7 actually had some weird music that was actually like a little bit different and kind of trippy.
That's a Super Nintendo game.
Yeah. It is. But I mean, I'm not discussing from a technical standpoint. I'm purely musical standpoint.
Okay.
I'm abstracting out from what the hardware limitations were.
Sure.
And like I think that's up there with some of the Super Nintendo games. I mean, for me, again, it goes back to my undying affection for the X series and its use of ridiculous guitar riffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did have ridiculous guitar riffs. I mean, for me, 2 is definitely the one for me where it's just like built into my DNA where I can turn that game on and I'm like, and it's like, and then like I found myself later on in the game and I would just sit there and I wouldn't even be thinking about it and I would just find myself just humming the music. And I would know the entire musical track. Bear in mind, I haven't played the game. I don't even know how long. I haven't played it since like the 90s. Easily, it's been a long time.
I would hear someone yodeling the Mega Man tunes. But it just happened. It just happened.
So in the forums, our friend Sundulos wrote, "I have to say that I had forgotten how much I like some of the music of some of the stages in this game, particularly that of Magnet Man, Spark Man, and Snake Man stages.
Snake Man.
Probably my personal favorite, as well as the title song. As this was probably one of the first games I bought for myself as a kid, I played it to death. Those stages really hit the nostalgia button. They probably rank among my favorite stage music in the entire classic Mega Man series."
Yeah, I mean, so I actually went and dug out some music for this. So while I was working today, just like having my phone there, I can just pull up whatever song in the world on YouTube if I so desire, which is amazing. And, you know, like I was just, I would get on a track and then I would just go to the related video and just work my way through. And some of the most creative, you know, reworks of Mega Man themes come from this game. And it seems like almost universally they're just from that little Proto Man whistle. Like there's so many takes on that one, maybe three measures of a harmony that it's kind of amazing.
The part that you hear most of the game is only five notes long.
Yep.
Right.
There's an extended version you hear at the very end.
Yeah, and you can also press start apparently, and he goes on like the music goes on.
There's really? There's a way to make him continue to play the music right before he leaves.
Yeah.
And then it loops for a little while, and then all the music just cuts out. Huh. It's just silence. And it's just you and the sound effects. It's really bizarre.
That's neat. Actually, I posted something in the forum thread and also on our Facebook and Twitter pages. But there's a project online where this guy hacked basically wrote a rearrangement of the Mega Man 3 soundtrack to use the Konami sound chip that they developed for the Japanese version of Castlevania 3.
What?
Wow.
That has three extra audio channels, and so it's all the same Mega Man music. But he's added extra audio channels to kind of enhance, you know, play little counter melodies underneath and extra bass lines and stuff. It sounds ridiculously good. And if you enjoy the music of Mega Man, I would strongly recommend that you go and check out that link. It's in the forum threads, or go to our RFN Facebook page. You'll find the link there. It is hypnotically awesome.
Wow.
And something that would never happen in real life, you know, but thanks to hacker fans, we can enjoy, you know, a Capcom game playing on the Konami sound chip.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It is great.
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there's so much neat stuff just in the music, what it does from a technical standpoint, the kinds of melodic things it's doing with a relatively limited sample set that is particularly impressive.
Yeah.
For just from a musical theory standpoint, how it uses keys really well to sort of give you this sort of stilted perspective of what the music's doing, I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Shadow Man stage there's this one kind of like discordant note that plays. I think it's kind of a piano-ish note. Mm-hmm. And it comes at a weird moment in the melody, and it gives the whole stage kind of a darker, more sinister feeling than it would have otherwise.
That's what I'm talking about. Or like, the Protoman theme is kind of minor, so it ends on a really minor note.
It sounds sad.
Yeah,
You know, and one thing I love about Mega Man music in general across most of the games is that Capcom were really the pros at putting in catchy beats into NES music. These games had bass lines, and I think that's kind of a technical trick that they were able to program in, because most NES games do not have very impressive bass, you know, but it really fits the theme. I mean, the whole theme of, you know, you got to remember the Japanese name is Rockman. He is the rock and roll video game robot superstar, and the music is supposed to be rock music, which was kind of revolutionary to do on the NES sound chip. And I think they just pull it off. I mean, the songs are catchy, they're fun. They're mostly lighthearted, but they're also they have this driving rhythm that is so unusual for 8-bit music. And again, I mean, Konami is probably the only other company that could pull it off with any kind of regularity.
But again, those companies have super distinct, not just their sound chips, because they are different, but musical styles.
I mean, the composition styles are very different.
It goes back to when we used to do radio trivia. It's like, I know this is a Capcom game circa 1991. Right. Like, I don't know which one it is, but it definitely came out between June 1990 and February 1992.
Yeah, which is really weird when you're listening to, like, the Little Mermaid music from NES. It's like, wow, this kind of sounds like Mega Man. Oh, and so Chippendale's Rescue Rangers, that sounds like Mega Man 2, you know. I love that kind of thing. But, yeah, Mega Man 3, the music is just absolutely fabulous. And even if you hate everything else about the game, I'm sure you will appreciate the music. So, guys, we need to wrap up this conversation. I thought it was a pretty good one. I hope everyone at home enjoyed it. I hope you've been playing along. If not, like, this game is very easy to get. It's very cheap. It's short.
It's available 100 ways.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, it's on every platform under the sun, and it's a true classic. So I hope you know, you've been inspired and that you will go check it out for yourself. But I do want to extend another very big thank you to everybody who played along, who voted in the poll, who posted in the forum thread. And there really are a lot of great comments in there that we did not have time to get into. It's a pretty meaty retroactive thread, a lot of different people posting in there. There's a whole sub-conversation about just the order of boss battles and who's best to go after first, and, you know, what sequence do you play through. And a lot of people have very different ways of you know, tracking a pathway through the game. And it's really cool to see that, you know, the cool thing about the whole Mega Man series is that you choose the order that you do the levels. And what you see here is just proof that everybody plays it a little bit differently, and it affects the experience that you have, you know. So really interesting stuff there, and I hope you'll go check out the forum thread and catch up on all that great opinion from all of our listeners. So before we go, I just wanted to remind everybody, we are planning to go back to listener mail next week and probably do a lot of it. We've got a lot of great emails to catch up on, and there's some big topics, like I mentioned at the top of the show. There's some big things going on we haven't talked about yet, so this may be an opportunity for us to do that. Anyway, we hope you will write in. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and there's always a link in the show notes on the website as well, so you can click there. And we love getting emails. You know, we can't, it's just impossible for us to reply to every email or to read everyone on the show, but we actually read all of them, and we really do appreciate all of them. So thanks, everybody. Even if you write in and you never hear back from anything, it really is appreciated. It really is. It keeps us going. It keeps us thinking about these topics throughout the week as we continue to get emails. And a lot of times we'll even discuss them amongst ourselves, even if we never reply to you. So it really is.
Doesn't do you a lot of good.
Yeah.
No,
it is fodder. It's food for thought, though, a lot of the time. I mean,
it is food for it's important. It really is.
Yeah.
It gives us a lot of food for thought.
And if you write us hate mail, we're really going to talk about it.
But it's always interesting for us to see kind of what other people think about stuff. Because the thing is, a lot of the emails that we get are they're actually deep thoughts about what we talk about, right? Like, it's just actually people sitting down and actually really thinking about what we talk about and giving us their take on something. So it really is appreciated. We read through them all.
Some of the best emails we get are just so in depth and long and, you know, very intelligent, well planned out responses or treatises on whatever's going on in gaming. And
they don't fit in this podcast.
Yeah, there's no way to read it on the show. I mean, this would just sound like nonsense, me reading it. It wouldn't do it justice for me to read this out loud on the podcast.
We need an economist to come in here and explain it.
Yeah.
But we do read them, and we really do appreciate them. I hope you'll write in. It's a major part of the show. All this interactivity, you know, this is what we thrive on. This is what keeps us going. It's why we keep doing it. And actually, in terms of interactivity, I wanted to mention, this is something that comes up every now and then, but we don't talk about it very often. I just wanted to thank our friend Donald Shaman. We read a quote from him on Retroactive, but he runs the NeoGAF thread. And, you know, NeoGAF is a huge forum and many more users than we have on our own forums. It's very important to this. It's massive, you know. But it's very important to me. I've been a NeoGAF member for over a decade, and this show ran for years and years and years, and it was hardly ever mentioned. at GAF, and I would go there and people would start talking about podcasts, and it always made me excited when someone would bring up our show and recommend it to people. Now we have our own official forum thread, and Shaman does a great job of putting in the new episodes in there, and every time he does, it creates new discussion there, and it's great. I get to read that side by side with the talkback threads in our own forums, and it's like just two very different perspectives, different people. It's just wonderful, and I just wanted to thank him and recommend that you check out that thread. It's also a great resource. The very first post has like an index of some of our best episodes and every retroactive we've ever done. It's a great way to go find your favorite episodes too. And finally, before we go, you hear this on a lot of podcasts. We don't say it all that often, but actually it would be a big help for the show. Maybe you're not good at writing emails. Maybe you don't have money to buy a t-shirt or contribute to the marathon. Maybe you're afraid to call in on the live shows, whatever. But if you love this show and if you have iTunes, if you could just search for Radio Free Nintendo in the iTunes store and click on the stars and give us a rating or even write a few words for a review, it would be a big help. It helps more people discover the show. When more people listen to the show, we get more interaction and we have more great features like Retroactive and Listener Mail. So we really would appreciate that as well. All right, that's all. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Later.
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 Latest.
Boom.
They're this very, very punitive, I guess. Punitive?
Punitive.
Yeah. Punitive also. I'm sure there's lots of puns. But punitive. Oh. And
fuck.
I'm sorry.
Oh my god.
Feel free to do with that, what you want.